expenditure. Honourable members from our side, Mr. Gordy is chairing SCOPA and will join us after lunch. Ms. Maseko and Mr. Singh are on parliamentary duty somewhere in Africa, I think. And I guess other members will join us as we go on. Singh and Maseko. And others will join us as they did yesterday when they're done with the other committees. In terms of our program today, honourable members, we have the South African Catholic Bishops Conference. We've given them 20 minutes, Advocate Papia, and in 20 minutes or 30 minutes we will engage with your engagement, and immediately thereafter we will have Council for Advancement of the South African Constitution. And after them, it will be right to know. Honourable members, you'll notice that yesterday we had people that had not appeared before this committee before. And today, everybody that's appearing before this committee had appeared. And we then request that, in the main, if you could focus on the draft that we've had. Where you think that we've fallen short, please feel free to indicate, or where we think that we've gone overboard, please feel free to indicate. We're really encouraging against starting something new, because we've got a draft that you participated in the first round, but if you think that we haven't done justice to it, please feel free to do it, but in terms of new ideas, we were a bit lenient yesterday because those were first-timers, but yourself, you've been here before. So having said that, I'm looking at Mr. Dumede and Mr. Self. Can we continue, sir? Fine. All right. Then we'll hand over to advocates. It is the... it's number 21 in your pack, the submission from the Catholic bishops. They don't have a executive summary PowerPoint, so I would imagine the advocate will talk directly to his document. Over to you, advocate.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning. Good morning to members of the committee. Before I start, may I just comment that it's very encouraging to see how quickly the committee has kind of turned this around and moved from initial hearings to draft bill stage, and even the publication of draft regulations doesn't always work that quickly in Parliament, as we know, so it's very good to see, and thank you. As we've said in our written submission, in broad terms, we support the bill, and we think that it goes a very, very long way to satisfying most of the requests of civil society in particular that were brought before you at the last round of hearings. We've got various specific comments that I'd like to make, and I'll keep them as brief as possible. Firstly, the draft bill sets up two funds, but if we dig into those two funds, we find that there's no real difference between the two of them other than the source of the money that comes into them. The one fund will receive public money, the other fund will receive private money. Thereafter, they appear to be completely identical. The money can only be spent for the same purposes. It will be distributed between parties according to the same ratios. So the question arises, why do we actually then have two funds? It can only result in duplication of costs and expenses and auditing and administration and so on. That scenario would obviously change if the monies that come into those two funds could be used for slightly different purposes, or if different criteria could be applied to the use of the money. So if the committee decides ultimately that money should be used for the same purposes and subject to the same restrictions, then we would suggest that you just do away with the distinction between the two funds entirely. They're both administered by the Electoral Commission anyway. On the other hand, we would prefer to see is that you do indeed distinguish not only between the income of the two funds, but how the money can be used. And we make certain suggestions there at 1.2 of our presentation. In essence, the two funds should serve slightly different purposes, and we suggest that the Multi-Party Democracy Fund, which will receive private donations, should allocate its funding in a way that really promotes the concept of multi-party democracy, rather than simply rewarding parties which have already gained representation. So I guess what I'm saying is that we would call for a distinction between represented political parties on the one hand, and represented parties plus others on the other hand. So the multi-party fund, multi-party democracy fund, could then become an instrument for widening access to include those parties which perhaps at the moment don't have representation nationally or provincially, but which have established some sort of a track record or have come close to gaining representation, and who could argue perhaps that the only thing that stands between gaining a seat or seats and not is the fact that they don't have any real funding to put forward their platforms to reach the public, etc., etc. We're not talking about fly-by-night parties. As we know, a number of them pop up every time we have an election and they disappear the day after the election. They're never heard of again. I'm not talking about that, but we could come up with criteria that say, for example, parties which have contested two or three successive elections, in other words, they have they're serious about contesting, or which have gained, for example, two-thirds or three-quarters of the number of votes that would be required on average to get a seat. I think at the moment for the National Assembly, roughly 50,000 votes or something like that gets you a seat. If you're a party that's got 35 or 40,000 votes and you've managed that in successive elections, maybe some attention should be given to some support for such a party. That would widen access to multi-party democracy. The other way that we suggest is that the Multi-Party Democracy Fund could really skew its allocations in favour of equity. So a much greater proportion of its income should be equitably distributed between parties as opposed to the represented party fund. So that's just how we see that you might think about distinguishing between these two funds. If I can move on to 1.3, the next point is donations from foreign governments. I think there's an intuitive resistance to the idea of allowing foreign powers to influence domestic politics, and that's quite understandable. But I think we do need to interrogate that a little bit. You're proposing to set up a system whereby the Independent Electoral Commission will control these funds. They will receive all the funds, they will administer them according to the Act and the regulations and so on. There's no question that it can be bypassed in some nefarious way. So why not be prepared to allow, in a sense, the IEC to receive foreign funding? It could still decide where that money goes. Control would remain with it. And it seems to us that there might be situations in which particularly agencies of a foreign government, and we still don't know quite what is meant by an agency, how broad is that, might wish to make a donation. I think last time I mentioned, for example, the German political foundations. I'm not sure whether you see those as agencies of the German government or not, but they might be. And they go around the world claiming to promote democracy in various ways. Maybe they'd like to give the IEC a great a donation to promote multi-party democracy, and it would be a great pity if that was precluded. Same obviously doesn't apply to private donations coming into political parties from foreign sources. That would be a different kettle of fish entirely. Regarding the prescribed formula for allocations, which we understand at the moment under the existing Act is 90% proportional and 10% equitable. We think that both funds, both envisaged funds, should move to a different ratio which would be at least 70-30, in other words, 70%, a maximum 70% distributed proportionately, 30% equitably, but we would also be happy to see that taken a bit further, just for example, to 60-40. I know that some civil society organizations are calling for 50-50 there. One of the points is that the larger and more well-established parties just find it much easier to attract private donations. They're already well known, the brand is out there, and we have to continually think of the new blood, the new ideas, the new emerging movements in our politics, and try to make life a little bit easier for them, and indeed to encourage that kind of dynamic movement in our multi-party democracy. Shifting those ratios would help in that respect. Move now to the question of the direct funding or the private funding of political parties directly. In 2.1, we've just set out one or two, in fact four, sort of definitional points, which I'm not going to go through in great detail. We may just have misunderstood a little bit, but perhaps some attention should be given to those. And then, almost perhaps one of the most important aspects of the whole enterprise here, the disclosure of donations. So we very strongly support the disclosure requirements set out in Clause 10. The whole crux of the thing is that the public has a right to know who is funding the political parties and to what extent are they being funded. The question is always raised, if you set a threshold, and we argue that you should, what about people who simply make lots of donations just under the threshold? That's obviously something which has to be tackled. Somehow you've got to bring in some requirement for the disclosure of cumulative donations or donations which cumulatively have the effect of exceeding the threshold. It shouldn't be too difficult. I see it's addressed in the regulations. I think it really belongs in the Act. And we've suggested some potential wording there. The threshold itself, what should it be? It's extremely difficult to come up with a figure or to provide a particularly sensible basis for a figure, but we've suggested 10,000 rands. I know that one or two other organizations have made a similar suggestion. Now, some of you with knowledge of your own party's finances may sit there and think, well, that's really peanuts. That would involve us having to disclose tens of thousands of individual donations. I don't know. Maybe some other parties are thinking, we'd love to get a few donations of 10,000 rand. But the point is that internally, simply for your own administrative purposes, you keep books of account. And you keep your spreadsheets, and you have your audits, and you have your financial reports. It's not that difficult simply to pass those over to the IEC. So it doesn't really involve the parties in any extra administrative burden to set a relatively low threshold. It does exclude, this threshold does exclude things like annual membership fees and, you know, the small once-off donations that you might get. Donations given at a party rally and things like that. We're not asking for those things to be recorded and disclosed. But I don't know. We can haggle around the 10,000 mark. We also think that whatever threshold you decide upon, it should be put into the Act and not just left up to regulations. Because we don't want a situation where in a couple of years' time, for whatever reason, the regulation is quietly amended and 10,000 becomes 100,000 or 100,000 becomes a million or whatever. The public, civil society, I think, has a right to comment on the question of the threshold. And that cannot really be guaranteed if it's done merely through regulations. If there has to be an amendment to the statute, then you have to more or less give us the chance to make submissions on that and explain why we agree or disagree with it. So for that reason, we would like the threshold to be stipulated in the Act. 2.4, the capping of donations. There's no provision in the draft bill for the capping of private donations to political parties, and we agree with that. I know that I'm not on the same page as some of my civil society colleagues in that respect. We don't believe that we're in a situation as, for example, that pertains in the United States, where you have these mega billion dollar donations. I'm not aware that happens in this country at all. If it becomes a problem at some point, there's nothing to stop Parliament revisiting it and saying things have gone out of hand. But if it's not a problem, if we're not seeing multi-hundred million rand donations that are actually skewing the way that our parties operate, that are actually influencing the policies that parties put before the public, then we don't think that there's a need for that particular remedy. Having said that, it's noticeable that in the draft regulation there's a reference in 6B to an upper limit for private donations. And it's not clear to me where that comes from or how the regulations can purport to stipulate a cap on private donations when the Act itself doesn't make provision for that. I don't think that can simply be introduced by way of a regulation unless there's some sort of empowering provision within the bill. So, again, unless I'm mistaken, perhaps some attention needs to be given to that point. We support the provisions regarding publication by the Commission, those are set up in clauses 10, 2 and 3. Again, one doesn't want to make, to create an onerous administrative burden by saying that the Commission must publish figures every month or something like that. Basically, an annual publication with a sort of heightened level of publication in election years seems to be quite a sensible way of approaching it. Then, the question of donations to members of parties. We are a bit confused by clause 11. There's a proviso at the end of the clause, except on behalf of the party. It's not clear to us whether that applies to members who receive donations or to the people who are making the donations as well. No person or entity may make a donation to a member of a political party for party political purposes, nor may a member receive any donation except on behalf of the party. Does that except on behalf, in other words, apply to the making of a donation or only to the receiving of a donation? But either way, we don't understand what the problem is. As long as it is for party political purposes and not for the personal benefit of that member, why should a member of a party not be the conduit, in other words, for a donation to be received and then passed on to the party? It's not clear what Clause 11 is trying to get at there. So maybe just some clarity on that aspect would be useful. And then 11.2 also has what seems to be an interesting provision. No person may circumvent subsection 1 or any of the provisions of this chapter. Almost by implication, it seems to invite circumvention of other chapters of the Act. Why are you stipulating that no one should circumvent this particular chapter? Surely no one is supposed to circumvent any provisions of any law. So again, unless there's a specific reason why that 11.2 is in there, it simply seems to add to the confusion. I've mentioned already that the thing about the regulation regarding the capping. There's also a reference to President making regulations in respect of matters contemplated in section 7.2e of the bill. There is no 7.2e, unless there's been a subsequent version of the draft bill. Seems that reference should be to 7.2d. Just on the question of the regulations, as far as we've been able to consider them, I don't have any specific submissions to make other than the one around the capping. But in general terms, one would want as little as possible to be left to regulation when it comes to the key questions of the right to know about things. That's got to be protected in the statute itself rather than subject to easy variation by change of regulations. Our second last point, Chairperson, is the question of investment entities owned by political parties, which is not addressed in the draft bill. It was raised and discussed in the previous round of hearings. We believe that it needs to be dealt with in the bill, and we think this is a very important point. Not having it there, to some extent, defeats the whole purpose of the bill. We're being told that we will know what donations political parties have received, and the reason why we need to know that is to be able to make judgments about whether those donations are affecting the policies and the behaviour of the party. Why then should we not also know whether a party's own investments, particularly if it has an investment arm, are not likewise to be linked to certain decisions that the party takes? This is particularly applicable, of course, when a party is in government, but as I said last time in the previous round of submissions, that doesn't mean only national government. Our politics appears to be, the levels of governorship, rulership in the country appear to be spreading in terms of provincial government, even city government. So, to keep secret where Chancellor House, for example, is investing, or if other parties have investment wings, whatever they may be called, where they are investing, and whether there are correlations between those investments and policy decisions, largely defeats the object of this, of the disclosure in the open. So we can't really understand why the drafters have decided to keep that out. We would like it to come back in and be dealt with in much the same way as any other private donations to parties are dealt with. And in case I haven't made myself clear, it's not going to help for the ANC in this case to publish the fact that Chancellor House donated 5 million rands to the ANC. We need to know where Chancellor House got the 5 million rands from in the first place. Lastly, the question of measures to encourage donations to political parties. It's all very well to set up the Multi-Party Democracy Fund. We obviously welcome that fund. But who's going to give money to it? The track record of corporate South Africa, private sector South Africa, donating to the existing fund, which they are free to do, is appalling. It's non-existent. Why should this change simply because you now give the fund? You split the fund and give it a new name. There's no indication that it's going to change. It's a matter of huge concern, I think, to a lot of us in civil society, just how little corporate South Africa and wealthy South Africa is willing to invest in democracy, how reluctant they are to put their hands in their pockets. They complain about everything. They do very little constructively. How do you change that? Unfortunately, it seems the only thing that they generally respond to is some sort of an incentive. And so we ask you to consider, and I try to keep a straight face while I'm suggesting this, that some sort of tax incentive be attached to donations to the Multi-Party Democracy Fund. They don't have to be wholly tax deductible, but there could be a partial tax deductibility, or perhaps some other incentive to try to get it going. Once it starts, once that fund starts to accumulate money, once one company is seen to be donating to that fund, the chances are that others will start to come on board. It will hopefully gain some sort of momentum. But without that, one's fear is that Parliament will continue to vote a certain sum of money every year to the represented party fund, and the other fund will sit with pretty much a zero balance. Those are our comments, Chairperson. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Advocate. Lots of food for thought, members. Welcome, Honourable Matthijs and Loda. You did indicate that you will be joining us late. So let me start while members apply their minds. And I'm just going to make submissions of where we are, and you can, in your response, tell us why you think we're crazy or otherwise in terms of what we think. Let's start with the threshold and upper limits and your assertion that those must be in the principal act. Now, our view is that the principle of a threshold and the principle of a cap should be in the act. The detail should be in the regulations. And our argument is that if, for instance, you said the threshold was 10 million and you put it in the act, a year down the line, inflation is such that 10 million is nothing. Then you must go and change the act as opposed to changing a regulation which is much easier. So that is why I'm just saying, let's put the principle in the act of a threshold, a cap or whatever it is, and the detail in the regulation. So that was the only reason why I differ with you, where you say that we must put as much as possible in the act. Somebody yesterday was saying, when I used the argument that we're buying a Porsche and the road is potholed. I said that? Oh, Rolls Royce. I'm changing it, I'm richer now. You're buying a fancy car and the road is potholed. Somebody said, no, but Smith, you're wrong. What you're actually doing is building a durable road so that any car can ride it. And I think that's what you're trying to do. So if the principle is there, whether it's 10% today or 30% tomorrow, as long as the road is durable, I'm saying that is the rationale why. But if all of you think that we're wrong and it should be in the principal act that we must say 10,000 rand in year one and then look at it every year, change the act every year, say so, we'll consider it. So I thought, let me just deal with the principle of why we think that. And it's not many, by the way. Let's clarify this. There are only three important disclosure pieces of information that are in the regulations. It's the 70-30, it's the upper limit, and it is the threshold. So South Africa mustn't labor under the impression that we have deliberately moved stuff to the regulations. Regulations only have three, and I think let's clarify them. And we will, as we indicated, discuss them and make them available. There's really only three that you could argue makes it difficult for you to take a decision because we don't have it in the principal act. Let me repeat, it's the 70-30. We've agreed in the act that we will change it. It's the threshold. I think there's reference in the act about the threshold. It's just about the rand and cents. And your point that there is no caps in the principle, I'm looking at the young men there. If it isn't, I think they should put it in and we should deal with it, because the sense is there should be a threshold. And we'll come and argue threshold just now. I just wanted to raise the principle, but if members don't talk to why we think there should be a threshold, I'll raise it later on. So I thought, let me, whilst members are gearing themselves up, just talk on the threshold and why we think it should be in the regulations and not in the acts. But you have the right to respond, and we'll come back to it. Having said that, I think members are now readily available to deal with anything else. Honourable Sal? Yes, sir?
Thank you very much indeed. Just to add on from what the chairperson has said, I think the other important thing is if you look at 23.1, it says that the President, acting on a resolution of the National Assembly, may make regulations in respect of matters inter alia 10.1, which is the threshold. And as I understand it, that is deliberate to allow for public participation in that regulatory issue as well, because that comes back to Parliament each time there's a change of regulation. But that's just by the by. If I can just deal with a couple of issues that arise out of your presentation with which I'm broadly in agreement. Okay. The first deals with the distinguishing purposes and your suggestion that one of the funds should be used to empower emerging political parties. your suggestion is that, you know, to try and move away from the two persons and a fax machine political party towards a serious contender, you should take their track record into account. But if you analyze the results of previous elections, you will see that in every successive election since 1999, there has been one emerging political party that has burst onto the scene. COPE in 1999, the ID in 2004, the COPE in 2009, and the EFF in 2014. All of them emerged from nothing and got into Parliament. So it seems to me that one needs to, if one wants to go this way, one would need to think of another way of recognizing serious players rather than, you know, people who regularly get 10,000 votes or 20,000 votes in successive elections. Then you made the statement, and I'd just like to test it, because the basis of your submission is that provided there's full disclosure, you don't think there should be a cap. If that is your reasoning, then it seems to me that if there is full disclosure, why should you not receive money from overseas as a political party? Because you'd be able to test this in exactly the same way. It was, I don't know, high-tashly influencing the policies of a particular political party or the tenders that they awarded. You made the comment that's a different kettle of fish entirely. But why is it a different kettle of fish given the line of reasoning in the rest of your paper? Your suggestion about 10,000 rands, I'm afraid I'm one of those parties that for which this would be an administrative nightmare. Because in practice, you get people giving money to a political party all over the country in small amounts of money. It gets receipted, the receipts get centralized. If we have to give an account of every 10,000 rand, particularly if it's cumulative throughout the year, I mean, it's going to be an administrative nightmare, I can tell you. I suspect that, you know, the cost of compliance would simply be too high to do that. And then, as I understand it, the explanation about prohibitions of donations to members of political parties deals with donations that are given, for example, to CR17 or NDZ17. They are donations to candidates who are fighting internal elections, and the same restrictions should therefore apply. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much. Anybody else? Honourable Gumede?
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson, and thank you to the South African Council of Bishops. My first question is around the question of funding, where we say it should be proportional and equitable. Why do you think that the Constitution stipulated that it should be proportional and equitable if everybody is going to be 50-50? That is the first area. The second area, the issue of disclosure requirements. I do understand that the public has a right to know. Do you believe that perhaps this requirement for disclosure should be graded. For instance, on a need-to-know basis, some things will be totally public, some things will be confidential, and some things will be private. And if so, do you think that there should be different mechanisms for handling that type of disclosure? For instance, we have seen an abuse of information when we disclose as members of parliament. And then you disclose that you have 100 shares at FNB, at different bank and so forth. And then all of a sudden in the social media they say that you own this, you own this. Now, for political purposes, internal political purposes, they say that you have shares in this company and therefore you promote this company. But your shares really are insignificant. But now, because of that disclosure of an insignificant amount of shares, because 100 shares in FNB is totally insignificant. But because of that information is abused by astute politicians to give preferences to some people. And this brings us then to the question of threshold. If the threshold is 10,000 K, but then 10,000 rands, the question should be, would 10,000 rands from one source influence a party? And then if not, why should we have 10,000 rands per contribution? But our politics have taught us that you declare honestly, but when people report, they do not report honestly. They say you are partly owned in FNB. They say you partly own FNB, you partly own this company and so forth. Well, theoretically, 10 rand shares is part ownership. But politically, it is significant when somebody now starts saying that you own shares in this company and the other company. Then the third area, the issue of capping. You say that there should be no capping. And these quantities are stated so that there should be no external influences to political parties except their membership. But now, if you have no capping at all, are you not going to have, say, in the Western Cape or in another province, donations that are to a scale that can influence the political parties, because they are not going to influence the whole political party. They influence an influential or some influential people in a political party, and say they want to have an oil rig or something, which may have severe environmental distinct consequences. But now, because of this, they give you 10 billion and then they, in the long term they'll be having thousands of billions of rands. So if we say there should be no capping, are we realistic? And also given the picture where the Namibian situation says donations should not be more than your total amount that you receive. The donations should not be more than 5% of the total amount you receive. Because they believe that if it is more than 5% from one source, that one source could influence that political party. So I'd like to hear your view in as much, in as far as that is concerned. I agree with you in investments, but that will be discussed further. And on the issue of companies on incentives, I think we are prepared to look at incentives in the long run, because really it makes sense. We are investing in a stable democracy, and people that make your democracy stable should be rewarded for that. Thank you.
Honourable Matthijs.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. Just clarity, so the recommendation that you're giving here is for the multi-party democracy fund. It must be split 50-50, so 50 must be divided proportionally, 50% must be divided equitably, which is in line with the Constitution. Do you have... because the Constitution also talks about the constituency allowance, so we must also just be clear that there's a constituency allowance that, you know, it's clearly stipulated it must be done proportionally. So I just want to be clear that this 50-50 recommendation that you are giving, and finally we have someone coming to give actual recommendations on amounts and percentages and stuff, which is very helpful. So just clarity on that. And you also saying that there should be no ban in how much money is donated into the multi-party democracy fund. So as you said, we're trying to build a very stable road so all cars can drive on it. So I want you to picture a scenario here, right? We have whoever is funding for a very long time, they're putting in 20 million every year, right, for maybe 2 years. All political parties are getting used to this sort of money. Then they decide to pull out, and then they start influencing us on the side, and then you can end up having all political parties captured. Do you know that's also a possibility, and we've all been influenced on the side, because now we're used to this 20 million that's been coming in donations, and we know that it's coming from company X or government X, etc. And we know that they want to do business here, and the next minute we all come in here and we're supporting the bill. So I'd also like you to speak to that, because the main thing is that we're also trying to avoid, besides us strengthening democracy, we also want to make sure that our MPs and our political parties are making decisions in the best interest of South Africans and not being influenced outside of that. So how would you suggest we're going to handle that? Thank you.
Let me remember the past. I've covered most of the issues you raised, but let me, and I don't know if it's deliberate, they left the most contentious one. I'm not sure why, but let me tackle it for whatever it's worth. You make a false statement that says you don't understand why we've got a problem with foreign donations into the multi-party fund. You understand why it shouldn't go to the political parties. Now, in my own view, and we will discuss it later, you know, I don't understand why it's acceptable that the UK, the USA, and many other countries ban foreign donors. But here in South Africa, we must accept it. And the argument that is used is we must accept it because it's helping democracy. I think it's patronizing that 23 years down the line we must be dependent on somebody for our democracy. I really do. Because I don't know that we should be babysat in terms of what is democracy in South Africa 23 years down the line. And let me be bold and say, we can't as South Africans argue that we've got a Rolls-Royce constitution. And in the next breath then say, let's accept money from a country that probably has a worse human rights record than we have. And think that that country must babysit us. I don't believe that we should as South Africans accept any foreign donations. I really don't. if democracy is so important to South Africans, then South Africans must pay for their democracy. Because dependency on foreigners for our democracy, as Honorable Matthijs has said, one day they'll pull the rug. One day they will pull the rug. Whoever this foreign force is will pull the rug. Then what happens? Do we then say South Africans' democracy goes back to 23 years? I just think it's wrong. I really think it's wrong, but I think members must look at it. But dependency on foreigners to assist our democracy 23 years down the line doesn't reconcile with somebody saying we've got the best constitution and they must follow our constitution. Some of these countries that purport to want to help us have worse track records than we have. Worse track records than we have. So why should we accept their money? Why should we accept their money? So I'm just raising that point because you're saying let's accept foreign donations, and members will look at it, and I'm saying it aloud so that those that come back to us later on, if you think that it's a good idea to accept foreign donations, please raise it, but you're going to be challenged on the basis of dependency and on the basis, and this is my, of it's quite patronizing to think that we must accept donations from somebody who, I don't know, is some saint that knows democracy better than we do. I just don't accept it. Over to you, sir.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll deal with the various points in order. You started with the question around, you know, keeping the detail in the regulations where it usually goes and having the principles in the Act, and I agree with that, generally speaking, but I think that there are times when it's also important to have what might appear to be detail, in this case actual figures for relating to the proportional equity split and the threshold and possibly the upper limit. Those details ought to be in the Act because they are crucial details. They are not just variable details. We're not just talking about a statutory interest rate that changes every year according to whatever Treasury decides or something like that. In criminal law, for example, I know in the Prevention of Organized Crime Act, and I think also in the Minimum Sentence Law, the Criminal Law Amendment Act of 1997, the provisions relating to the type of fraud that could get you life imprisonment and so on are stipulated in the Act itself, R1 million or whatever the case may be. I don't know if they've been changed over the years. But it was clearly seen as important enough then to place in the actual Act and not simply in some set of regulations. Those, now, admittedly, those are criminal provisions and slightly different legal principles apply. But I think that the underlying idea is basically the same, that some details are important enough to appear in the Act itself, and I would simply argue that this is one of them. I take note of what Mr. Self has said about the change being brought about by a resolution of the National Assembly. If there is an opportunity prior to such a resolution for public hearings on the proposed change in threshold, for example, that might answer the need quite adequately, but I'm not sure that those resolutions always come with an opportunity, as amendments to a statute do, for full public consultation. So one would need some clarity there. Moving on then to Mr. Self's other points. Empowering emerging parties and how to recognize the serious players. The underlying point for us here is that the presumption all along in the existing statute and in the proposed new statute is that the only parties that have call on public money, the money allocated by Parliament, or the private money that will be administered by the Electoral Commission are those that have already achieved representation. So representation of at least one seat in a provincial legislature somewhere is the bottom line, and we're simply asking why. Why must that be the bottom line? There's obviously a certain logic to it. You've shown that you can at least attract the support of, you know, a certain number of people. That's what it comes down to. But it doesn't take much to think that, for example, in one election, just in terms of the number of people that pitch up to vote. You might get a National Assembly seat with 40,000 votes nationally. The next election, suddenly, you know, many, many more people come to vote, and you require 55,000 votes to get the same seat again. In the one scenario, you're then entitled to public funding, and in the other scenario, you're not. That doesn't seem to be particularly logical. In other words, simply the fact of owning a seat in a provincial or national legislature doesn't seem to be a sufficient criterion for getting access to funding. We've made some suggestions about how you might approach it. Otherwise, maybe there are other ideas as well. And with respect, I don't mean this in a flippant sense, one can also see that the parties that have already made it into parliament and into provincial legislatures would be quite keen to divide the pot, the pool, the kitty amongst themselves. Why would you want to see money going to all sorts of Johnny-come-latelys and people popping up here, there and everywhere who wish to become represented parties? But maybe you should be open to that. Why not receive private funding from overseas? And you ask me why is it a different kettle of fish? I think it's a different kettle of fish because we inherently do not want foreign powers to influence domestic politics. And this perhaps ties in with one of Mr. Gumede's points as well. We don't want a situation where we discover that government X has bought a local political party in effect for some geopolitical purpose or some regional political purpose, or whatever the case may be, or for, you know, that party, if it happens to be in government, to guarantee support at the United Nations or in some sort of multilateral forum or whatever. One wants to avoid those situations. Now, you can argue, and I'll argue further on in my responses, that we'd find out soon enough because we're going to look at your disclosed donations, but perhaps the harm has already been done by the time we find out. The bill does make provision for to accept foreign money for policy development purposes and for the training and skills development of members of political parties in Clause 9.3. We don't quite know what policy development of a political party encompasses, but there's at least some sort of opening there for you to receive donations from foreign entities. That does not include foreign governments, as far as I can see, or foreign government agencies. But again, it points to perhaps the need for clarity in definitions of those things. The threshold, the 10,000 rands, I accept that from what you say that it could be an administrative nightmare. We're not wedded to 10,000 rands by any means, but you've got to start somewhere. We would rather start low and then have the political parties explain why that is unrealistically low and sort of haggle upwards from there. I've got no idea how of your internal workings and how these things all happen. But if 10,000 is really laughably low, then fine, make it 100,000 if that's more realistic. But let's not have a situation where, you know, we make it unrealistically high so that only really kind of headline-grabbing donations are ever disclosed. We want to know, by and large, apart from your ordinary members paying their ordinary membership fees in the normal course, apart from the little bit of money you get from selling a T-shirt here and there, we want to know who's giving you substantial sums. In the world of civil society, 10,000 rand remains a fairly substantial sum. If it isn't in the world of the DA, then good luck to you. but yeah, let's start on the low side and justify raising it. Yeah, the donations to individual members, obviously there's some sort of an attempt there to stop the fueling of factionalism, I suppose, within parties, but it needs to be tightened up in my submission to make it clear that a member can receive money as a conduit, that it's not a crime for MP so-and-so at a public function to accept a check for the funding of his political party or her party. I don't think that Clause 11 is yet clear enough in that respect. I mean, I don't want to get into a debate about why people shouldn't be free to donate to CR 17 and anything else 17 and so on and so on. Well, you know, it's a free country, as they say, and our politics should be as free as possible. Is it actually such a bad idea that members of the public should be able to support, financially support candidates who are clearly contesting for office within the political party? It's not clear to me that that's necessarily such a bad idea. Our politics tends always to have this kind of negative cast on contestation. We even have some political parties who tell us that it's not within their tradition to contest. We have to have pure consensus. I'm not sure that that's necessarily desirable or realistic at all. And you can't contest without money. But this is not about the funding of individual politicians. It's about party funding. Mr. Gumede, why does the Constitution stipulate a proportional funding and an equitable funding if everyone is just to be 50-50? I think the point for us is that the Constitution says a certain amount of the funding that goes, public funding that goes to political parties, must be equitably distributed, and a certain amount must be proportionately distributed, and that's fine. But it doesn't say what those amounts ought to be. And at the moment, the 90-10 split seems once again unduly to favour the established parties that have strong representation, particularly because the formula goes on to allocate according to the number of seats that you have. So it's always going to overly favour the most heavily represented parties and act as a damper on the newly emerging parties. We don't think that that's desirable. You raised the question of a graded disclosure, that some there would be some totally public disclosure and some private or withheld things on a need-to-know basis and so on. With respect, I don't think that that would really be workable. I think it would be very difficult to come up with a system where certain donations to a political party could be graded as confidential or secret and others would be graded as open. Disclosable. Who would do that? Who would make those decisions? It clearly could not be left to the political parties themselves, because they'd have a self-interest in not disclosing, perhaps. Would you require the IEC to make that judgment call? And what would happen if the IEC and the party concerned disagreed on what should be disclosed? Our position all along has been there must be disclosure of all funding. The only qualification to that is the threshold question. But we would be opposed to any sense of a graded disclosure. That would defeat largely the purpose of the openness that's contained in the bill. You raised the question of the abuse of information. I think it's an important question. People do misreport and they sensationalise things. We know that, but surely the correct response then is not to try to close down access to information, but to make it all the more freely available and all the more clearly available. You fight misinformation with more information, not with less information. The question of capping, you also raised that. Is it realistic not to have a cap? Might we not find that, you know, there is, as you say, a mega million or billion dollar donation and so on? Well, that will have to be disclosed. And one would then pretty soon find out that there has been such a donation. I accept that if the donation comes in February and a policy decision is taken as a consequence in April or May and the report only comes out at the end of the year, it may in a certain sense be too late. But at least the voters then will still be able to connect the dots and find and make their judgment about it. But our underlying point, once again, is that no one has so far suggested, to my knowledge anyway, that excessively large donations to political parties are a problem in this country. If they aren't, if it's not a problem, maybe we should just leave it, monitor the situation, which the IEC can do, and if it becomes a problem, address it then. I just don't think that there's a need for a cap if capping is not yet a problem. Honourable Matthijs' questions about the question, what happens if all political parties are captured via the multi-party fund? hope that the majority, if not all the political parties, are of sufficient integrity not to be captured simply by the fact that they might get more money from the fund. But I mean, you seem to be suggesting that, you know, if corporate South Africa really came, excuse the pun, came to the party and started donating vast sums of money to the multi-party democracy fund, that all the parties would suddenly want to adopt policies friendly to corporate South Africa, that they would allow themselves to be captured in that sense. I don't think, with respect, that that's a realistic kind of a scenario. And if they did, one would expect that the parties that currently trade on a non-corporate South Africa kind of platform would cease to exist. They would be regarded as having betrayed their voters. Some other party would pop up to take their place. So no, I don't think that there's a chance that having a thriving multi-party democracy fund heavily supported by corporate South Africa, wealthy South Africans, is going to influence and capture parties across the board. I don't see that happening. And then the last point, I think, Mr. Chairperson, was yours around foreign donations. Why should we accept them? Isn't it patronizing? It is to a certain extent. I can understand your sentiment. But as a country, we accept vast amounts of foreign development assistance, aid of various kinds and so on. We have government-to-government agreements in various sectors. We receive large amounts of EU funding, for example. We're now beginning to receive government-to-government aid and other donations of a kind from China, which is, in my view, the world's greatest human rights violator of any country. It violates the rights of all 1.2 billion of its own citizens on a daily basis. It's not a democracy. We take their money for all sorts of things. Why would we not take other countries' money for the promotion and the development and the enhancement of our democracy? We take it for the enhancement and development of our infrastructure, of our education system, and of all sorts of other things. But I do agree with your basic point that one does not want our democratic system to become dependent on foreign funding. That's not the idea. I don't think we should be going cap in hand to foreign entities saying, please give us money for our parties. No. But that's not to say that we should ban it outright. If, in the view of the IEC, and once again the IEC is empowered with control over these matters, a credible, no strings attached, useful donation is offered from a foreign entity, why not? There's nothing that that donation can do to unduly influence our parties or our system, because it comes via the control of the IEC. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. As usual, the second round members, but while you're thinking about it, let me just touch on two issues. Your point that you were trying to address with Mr. Self, and please help us, not you, but everybody else. Mr. Self's question about, and it's been raised by many people, about non-represented parties. Now, my reading of Section 236 of the Constitution says funding of political parties to enhance multi-party democracy, national legislation must provide for the funding of political parties participating in national and provincial legislations. That's what it says. Now, I don't know, maybe my English is not good enough, but participating would mean you already have a seat. Now, your argument is that what is the magic of having a seat? Let's give it to somebody who has a track record. Well, that's, if I'm understanding the Constitution, unconstitutional. And I'm saying, help me, if I'm understanding it. Because that is what has driven us, and maybe we must go and look at it. But it says the legislation must facilitate multi-party democracy. And it says those that are already participating. I'm not for 1 minute saying that let's close the door to those that are not, but there are a whole myriad of reasons why we've argued that that will be difficult. So if you could just explain that to us. Over and above what Mr. Self has said about track record doesn't necessarily answer our question. So if you could answer that. And then at some point, and I thought members would raise it, you said that we should maybe incentivize big business to
contribute by maybe making their donations tax deductible or tax-free or that type of thing. Again, I'm looking at members at this side and yourself also. If we went that route here, do we not run the risk of this becoming a money bar? And we don't want it to become a money bar. I do think we raised it at some point with, or somebody raised it with the Minister of Finance many years ago, and the Minister of Finance said, try something else. Then, I think it was Mr. South that said that to us, or somebody said that to us. So I'm saying, even if this new minister said, let's talk about it, do you not run the risk of making this a money bar? If we start...
If the expression says this in the money?
A money bar. When we start talking about rents and cents in terms of tax allowances and tax deductible allowances and stuff. Because we don't intend this to be a money bar. And then the other point I thought Honourable Matthijs will raise it, because it is something that we must consider, Honourable Members, and discuss. This thing around the investment vehicle. It was indeed discussed. Our rationale was, so why be this specific about investment vehicles if we say there should be total disclosure? That was the one side of the argument. Other political parties came here and said, you know, we could prove that, let's take the Chancellor House one, for instance. Chancellor House, all those that are running it, there is no closeness between the Thule House and them. They are somewhere else. So is that really an investment arm of the ANC? Is it not? I'm saying that was an argument that was raised, that you'd get somebody. Because you're saying we should disclose the investment arm. What happens if everybody turns around and says, we do not have an investment arm? And how do you prove that that's an investment arm of the ANC or the DA or the EFF, other than having some sort of directors of the ANC, I mean, directors of that investment arm are elected officials of a political party. I'm just trying to understand it. I thought our argument of, once we make it totally disclosable who you're getting money from as a political party, doesn't matter whether it's an investment arm or whether it's the drug lord or whether it is rich somebody, we would be able to connect the dots. And I think that was the rationale that we came up with eventually, why we haven't specifically put the word investment up, but we thought we would cover it in that fashion. If South Africans feel that we need to strengthen it a bit, then you need to tell us why our rationale is maybe flawed or not strong enough. I just thought I'd raise those, because you had raised them earlier and nobody, including myself, responded to them. So it's the whole issue around the tax that you raised, the investment arm, and I'm just revisiting your argument with Mr. Self about unrepresented political parties, because it has come up. We can't pretend that it hasn't come up. Is there any second round bite that members would want to take? Otherwise, it'll allow you to respond to those and move on. Any second round that members would want to take? Going, gone. Advocate.
Thank you, Chairperson. Section, does it 236 of the Constitution, that there must be legislation which supports parties participating in the assemblies. That sets us, as I understand it, a minimum. You must provide for support for parties that are represented or that are participation. It does not stop you as Parliament from going further. And in addition to the constitutional requirement, not in opposition to it, but in addition to it, providing for the support for other political parties that are not yet participating. So I think that would be a fairly simple answer to that point. I don't think that by including non-represented parties you would be violating the Constitution. You would be deepening, if you like, that provision, and it is open to Parliament to do that. As for this becoming a money bill, I think that what I would be suggesting, if it was to be taken seriously, and I doubt very much whether it would be, it's going to be, but for form's sake anyway, you could ask Treasury to consider extending the provisions in the Income Tax Act that currently govern tax deductions. ask that the multi-party democracy fund be given that kind of status, as many, many other entities already have that sort of status in the Income Tax Act. That would be, I think, the way to do it. So you wouldn't do it directly in this bill, but you would go through the finance minister to get to that point. But I know that there is, always has been, tremendous resistance in this country to using the avenue of tax deductibility to get to those points. Even back in most Emmanuel's day, he tramped on many such ideas very quickly and thoroughly. We think they're worth exploring. The question of the investment vehicles. The reality in our country at the moment is that there's no secret that the one that we know of, the one that has been in the news over the years, Chancellor House, is connected to the governing party of the country. No one seriously denies that. It takes its name from Nelson Mandela's law chambers and so on and so on. You're suggesting that it might be possible for a party to set up an investment arm and have it really at arm's length, and how would we know that's possible? Perhaps that clause in Clause 11.2 about people not circumventing the provisions of the chapter could come into play if that were the case. But I would think that the purpose, again, is to prevent a situation where a political party merely hides the ultimate source of its income by saying, well, it came to us via this investment company. We got X from so-and-so company, Acme Investments. And we don't know, or we suspect that we can't prove, that investment company is doing deals with people who are also doing deals with government. We need to try to avoid that. So it doesn't seem to be too onerous to say that if a political party has an investment arm, or if it simply has a set of investments, which I assume most parties do, because they've got to put their money somewhere before they spend it, that there needs to be disclosure around those things. It's not simply saying if you happen as a party to have set up a specific entity like the Chancellor House. No. You've got investments out there. If the DA, for example, is heavily invested some company that does business here in the Western Cape, and we start to see that business getting favoured with tenders in the Western Cape government, once again would be able to join the dots. And it doesn't really matter whether the DA has an investment entity or simply a set of investments that correlate with policy decisions. That's what you want to get at. So to exclude that from the bill, I think, robs it of quite a lot of its force and effect.
Transfer for you by a donkey advocate for your date, and I got beaten, I couldn't carry on your time and your suggestions. We will certainly factor them in as we go along. We are now going to hear a presentation by Mr. Losa Naidu and his team, Council of Advancement of South African Constitution. Gentlemen, you can come and take your seat and we will take it from there.
Sanwanan, Niger. We are right. Thank you very much for coming. This is the portfolio or the ad hoc committee that is looking at political party funding. In other words, we're trying to make sure that these people that chow your tax money, chow it in a proper fashion. And we've got South Africans here telling us what they think we should do and what we shouldn't do. So it's public hearings. You're very welcome. We are listening to them from yesterday. We're listening to others today. Here we've got the Council for the Advancement of the South African Constitution giving us their views. Bazokulumanat, Bastia, what they want, and then political parties will tell them why we think they are talking rubbish, or they will tell us why they think we're talking rubbish, but it's in the spirit of building democracy in South Africa, and your attendance also assists in building democracy, so you're more than welcome to join us. We're going to hand over now to the team. You'll introduce yourself, gentlemen. The detailed presentation, honourable members, is presentation in your files. It's at number 9. And there is also an executive summary that you should have of the presentation that they are going to give us. Over to the team.
Thank you, Chair, and members of the committee, and members sitting in the public gallery. It's nice to see people here following these proceedings. Chair, we would want to begin by commending this committee for the work that it has done. I think it's important for us to say that publicly. This has been a very open, fair, participatory process, which I think shows the very best of what Parliament ought to be as an interactive process, engaging on serious issues. And this is, a very difficult issue. It's taken a long time for this matter to come before Parliament. And I think we appreciate the opportunity as members of civil society to engage with political parties in this forum rather than through the courts. I think this is a much more appropriate forum for these discussions. And I think political parties must be commended for bringing this matter here. And I think, I do want to make reference to the fact that, in particular, the ruling party or the governing party, in all my time of following Parliament, I have not recalled a member of the ANC's top six who is not a member of Parliament or a member of the National Executive come and address a committee meeting in Parliament, as Mrs. William Keyser did a few weeks ago. And I think that demonstrates the seriousness of the issue and the commitment of political parties to do the right thing in this regard. And I think we certainly appreciate that fact and the manner in which this issue has been dealt with. It does speak to the essential need to reform transparency in the funding of political parties, whether from the public purse and now from the private funders as well. Before going further, perhaps just to introduce my team. I'm Lawson Naidoo, the Executive Secretary of CASAC. To my left is Professor Richard Calland, who is a member of the Executive Committee and Advisory Council of CASAC. And to my right is Mr. Mike Law, a researcher who has assisted us with some of the work on the submissions that we have made to the committee. What we seek to do today is to make certain proposals as to how we believe the bill might be improved further from the draft that has been tabled before us. And we think there are some particular areas that we want to highlight in this process, and I think the issue, and many of those have been discussed already this morning and yesterday, the issue of foreign funding, the effective functioning of the Multi-Party Democracy Fund, the definitions of donors and what constitutes donations in kind, the imposition of upper limits on donations from single donors, the disclosure obligations on donors as well, the regulation of investment vehicles, which we've just discussed with Mr. Popier, and the importance of the regulations, which you have raised yourself this morning, Chair, and the three aspects that the regulations deal with. In relation to foreign funding, whilst we appreciate the desire to prevent foreign entities, as you've articulated, exerting undue influence on our politics We believe that this is no less true of local donors or any other private donors, that all donors have the propensity to exert such influence, and we believe that it is the intent of the donor rather than the source of the donation that should be the focus of the legislation and our regulatory regime. The real way to uncover attempts to influence political parties is, we believe, to entrench transparency and to require disclosure, and not simply to say that all those who fund political parties have nefarious agendas. Some of them might, but hopefully through this process we will weed those out. We also believe that developing countries and middle-income countries such as South Africa rely heavily on the influx of foreign money into our democratic structures, into government programs, as Mr. Pothier has already indicated. And in our written submission on this bill, we referenced a study that we did which supports this proposition. Our study looked at the wealthiest and poorest 25 countries where data is available on party funding laws, looking at them by both gross GDP as well as GDP per capita, and to consider whether such a ban on foreign funding is the norm amongst other countries. We tried to establish a link between the wealth of a country and its position on the foreign funding of its political parties. And the summary of the outcomes of this were that of the 25 wealthiest countries by gross GDP, 76% banned foreign funding and 24% permitted it. Of the 25 wealthiest countries by GDP per capita, 60% banned foreign funding and 40% permitted it. And on the other end, of the 25 poorest countries by gross GDP, only 20% banned foreign funding and 80% permitted it. And then of the 25 poorest countries by GDP per capita, 32% banned foreign funding and 68% permitted it. So I think what it shows is that it's a clear trend that the wealthier a country is, the more its democracy and political parties can sustain themselves domestically. Poorer countries rely more heavily on foreign funding as a result. While South Africa specifically does not appear in these studies, the fact that we are a middle-income developing country suggests that it might be more appropriate for us, and in keeping with that global trend, to permit donations to political parties from foreign donors. We also believe that banning foreign donations will compromise and hamper the ability of political parties to raise the funds necessary to execute their strategies and plans. So this is about a regulatory regime that is there to empower political parties to enable them to do their jobs. We don't believe that they will necessarily be able to raise all the funding that they require domestically. We also say that there is no reason to prohibit lawful donations from any foreign entity to the Multi-Party Democracy Fund. These contributions constitute an attempt to support our multi-party system as a whole, rather than to influence our internal politics. We also believe that political parties should not operate in a domestic bubble, and our experience shows the importance of inter-party collaboration, including funding, which strengthens political ties and helps parties to learn from the experiences of political parties in other parts of the world, many of whom may face similar challenges in an increasingly globalized environment. There are various foreign organizations that exist to help strengthen foreign political parties and structures in South Africa. And South Africa has benefited from them. In the short period of our democracy, they have played an important role, and we believe that they should be encouraged rather than prohibited. With regards to the Multi-Party Democracy Fund, we've reflected on all of the submissions that have been made on this bill and we've been present, as I'm sure you know, at many of the committee meetings and discussions that have taken place here. And we wish to therefore elaborate on both the rationale and the functioning of that Multi-Party Democracy Fund. We recall that this fund is really designed to receive money which is intended to bolster our multi-party system as a whole and to distribute those monies to all parties on a non-partisan basis. We therefore see no reason to ban any category of persons or entities from donating to this fund, whether domestic or foreign, so long as that donation arises from a lawful source. Many of the written submissions on this bill have proposed that donors to this fund not be permitted to remain anonymous. We do not support this view. It is our view that one of the key rationales for the creation of the fund was to provide an alternative to donors who may not wish their identities to be revealed in the light of the many concerns expressed to this effect during these committee meetings. We believe that to ban anonymous donations to this fund in particular would defeat one of its main purposes. It has also been said that there is no reason why entities or people who donate to this fund would not want this to be known. That may well be true, but we ought to allow some discretion to the donor in that regard, and in particular to the, to the multi-party fund. And we also must bear in mind that the identity of the donor will not be concealed to everyone. The identity must be disclosed to the Electoral Commission as the recipient body, and the IEC will be aware of where the money has emanated from. A further rationale for this fund is articulated, we believe, in its name. It is a fund to support, as I said, multi-party democracy. And we therefore believe that the allocation of monies from this fund should not unduly benefit the larger parties at the expense of smaller ones. And separate from the formula that might be chosen for the other fund, the public fund, we feel that a 50-50 split in this regard is both justified and demanded for the multi-party democracy fund. It does not, and we note that the committee has taken a view that the 90-10 split is not sustainable, and there needs to be a shift away from that, and we would propose that it be a 50-50 split in relation to the multi-party democracy fund, 50% proportional and 50% equitable. With respect to the formula for the allocation of funds from the registered political parties fund, or represented political parties fund, we believe that the formula again should be stipulated in the Act. We've argued that the 90-10 split is potentially unconstitutional, and while the committee may decide to agree on some other formula, whether it be 80-20, 70-30 or 60-40, such a formula must pass constitutional muster. The guiding criteria, we believe, for this formula is that it must be one that enhances multi-party democracy and therefore does not place smaller parties at a disadvantage in relation to more established and larger parties. We maintain that the wording of Section 236 of the Constitution indeed does support a 50-50 split between proportional and equitable. We're not saying that the formula needs to be the same necessarily for both funds, but we would motivate in that regard. Nor is it illegitimate for parties to be concerned that a revised formula will result in them losing a large amount of money. And that will undoubtedly be true for the larger parties. However, we must also bear in mind that over 900 million rands a year is being allocated to political parties from national and provincial legislatures. And we would argue that some of that money may well be reallocated to the represented political parties fund to cover some of the shortfall that parties may receive from the revised formula as a reduction in the size of the fund itself. We further submit that all parties that are entitled to receive money from this fund be allocated a minimum amount, and we're proposing that be 1% of the amount in that fund. So, for example, with the current value of the fund being roughly 150 million rands per year, this provision would result in all political parties receiving at least 1.5 million rands per annum from that fund. We also tackle the issue of the issue of dual disclosure, which we raised in our earlier submission, but doesn't seem to have gained much traction with the committee. We advocate that there should be an obligation on donors to disclose to the IEC donations that they make to political parties. We're not suggesting that they make public disclosure, but that donors have a responsibility to disclose to the IEC. And the rationale for this is to serve as a dual accountability measure, a belt and braces approach, if you like. It allows one to check whether there are discrepancies in the donations reported by political parties and those reported by donors. And the IEC would be well placed to do that on the basis of the information that would have been provided to them. Without this, we would say that the possibility exists, not that it would necessarily happen, but the possibility exists that parties may be tempted to hide or misreport donations to the IEC. And we also say that this obligation exists in several other jurisdictions and finds expression in electoral laws, company laws, as well as taxation laws in those countries. We also don't ask that donors be required, as I said, to publicly disclose simply that they report to the IEC. In an annexure to our submission, we have provided legislative examples of this obligation in several countries, in Ireland, Australia, India, Russia, and Singapore. To take as an example the Australian example, in Section 305A of the Australian Commonwealth Electoral Act of 1918, which has, has been amended several times to bring the amount up to date, and it provides subsection 1, and says, and I quote, a person must provide a return in accordance with the section if A, the person makes a gift or gifts during the disclosure period in relation to an election, to any candidate in the election, or a member of a group, and B, the total amount or value of the gift or gifts was 1, equal to or more than the amount prescribed for the purposes of this paragraph, or 2, if no amount is prescribed, more than 10,000 Australian dollars. So there's a clear example of a obligation on the donor to disclose. The next issue we tackle is that of the upper limits and the ceiling, and we say that this is necessary to have a ceiling in place in order to combat, as we said earlier, party capture, to avoid a single or small amount of donors capturing the interests of a particular party. We therefore propose that an upper limit be set on the amount that a single donor can donate to a single political party within a 12-month reporting period. We hadn't initially made any submission with regards to what that amount ought to be, what that upper limit ought to be, but we are saying that the foreign examples that we've researched demonstrate that this ranges from a few thousand to in excess of $1 million. And just to give some examples from foreign jurisdictions, in Belgium, it's 2,000 euros, in France, 7,500 euros, in Bulgaria, 13,000 euros, in Croatia, 46,000 euros, in Italy, 100,000 euros, in Russia, 4.33 million rubles, in Japan, $890,000, and in Portugal, it's set as 25 times the annual minimum wage. So one can see there's a vast range of figures that are used as a ceiling. And I think in South Africa, we would have to find a number that is appropriate and relevant to our circumstances. But we advocate the very principle that there should be an upper limit on donations from a single donor. And this ties in with our next point, which is that of the definition of a donor. Who constitutes a donor and how do we define that? We believe that it's vital to ensure that for the purposes of the Act are not frustrated by potential gaps and loopholes in the legislation, and this potentially provides that. If, for example, a combination of related entities all donate an amount just below the threshold to a political party, when the combined amount from those entities would exceed the threshold, they would be able to avoid disclosure. So as a hypothetical example, suppose that the threshold is 50,000 rands, and if a holding company, its subsidiary, two of its shareholders in their personal capacity, and a family member of each of those shareholders donates 45,000 rands each below the disclosure amount, an effective donation of 270,000 rand would be made to a political party without there being any disclosure. And that's something that we need to avoid. We therefore propose that the definition of a donor should include any person or entity substantially related to it, which would include a holding company and its majority-owned subsidiary, an individual person or persons and a company in which the former is a substantial shareholder, an individual person and a partnership in which the former owns a majority share in the partnership, a donor and a trust in which that donor is a trustee, the family of any donor, including the spouses of the primary donor and relatives in the first and second degree. We believe that this is important, as I said, to ensure that creative ways are not found to avoid disclosure. We also deal with the issue of a definition of donations in kind. We agree with the definition that's provided for in the Act, or in the bill rather, except for the exception that is created for personal services, for the provision of personal services. We argue that a personal service could be just as valuable as one that is provided by a corporate entity, and we need to tackle that. We therefore argue that the distinction should rather be based on the services, on the nature of the services. So if the services is professional in nature and would ordinarily be charged for, then that should be the determining factor rather than whether it's being provided by an individual or a corporate entity. We also take cognizance of the fact of a problem raised in a submission on the bill by Mr. Murray, that parties may use the membership fees exception to offer a form of premium membership to certain categories of members at a cost which exceeds the threshold and which would therefore constitute an undisclosed donation because it is a membership fee or defined as a membership fee. And we believe that that is another loophole that needs to be tackled and closed. In addition, political parties should be required to disclose all loans that are granted to them, regardless of the terms of that loan, because we believe that there's a danger of such loans being later written off by the grantor of the loan, claiming that it constituted a bad debt, it was not repaid, and they would then simply write it off. And that then also has tax implications, because the grantee of the loan would therefore not pay tax on that income that they had earned in the first place and set off as a loan. So that is a tax evasion ploy that I think we need to be aware of in relation to how loans may be used to get around both the disclosure requirement as well as avoiding taxation. In respect of the penalties that are provided for in the bill, our view is we do not believe that there are political penalties such as the deregistration of political parties should be as it is stated there. We fear that this could be abused for political purposes. If, for example, there is a view within the IEC or body that they want to take action against a political party, it is open to abuse. And we therefore believe that that is a matter that should be dealt with by the electoral court, as the Electoral Act currently makes provision for. The administrative fines that are proposed in the bill, we believe, should be changed so as to be proportional to the party's relative financial position, to be set rather as a percentage of the funds received rather than a fixed rand amount. So if you impose a fine of 50,000 rands, on the ANC or the DA, it's a mere slap on the wrist. To a smaller political party, it could well be have far more catastrophic consequences. So we believe that there should be some parity in how that the amount of the fine is calculated. We also tackle the issue of investment vehicles, which you've just been discussing this morning. And here we say that the issue of investment vehicles, we believe, falls squarely within the mandate of this committee, but we don't believe that has been adequately covered as yet in the bill. We would therefore suggest that the bill needs to deal with this more effectively, and we propose three measures to regulate investment vehicles. Firstly, that political parties must disclose any financial interest that they hold in commercial entities and any funds that they receive from those commercial entities. That secondly, that entities that are wholly or partly owned by political parties should not be permitted to contract with the state. And thirdly, that any donations that are made to such investment vehicles must be treated as a donation to a political party under the Act, because it is a mechanism to provide a benefit to the political party by directing the donation rather to a commercial entity, but actually ends up benefiting the political party itself. On the issue of the regulations that are provided for under the bill, many of these had been left in terms of the draft bill to be determined in the regulations, but we now see that some of those have now been addressed in terms of the proposed regulations. And we also believe that, as we had advocated, that there must be a commitment for the regulations to be passed simultaneously with the Act, or else it might render the process render the bill itself, the primary legislation, meaningless without the regulations. So we believe that some of the issues that are dealt with in the regulations could and should be stipulated in the Act, including the formulas for the distribution of the monies from the two funds. We also say that the draft regulations don't include many of the important issues that remain to be decided. These, we believe, are beginning to be discussed now, and that in terms of the ceiling and the threshold limits as well. And I think we're pleased that the chair has reassured us this morning that there will be opportunities for public comments on those regulations as they are, and as they are amended in due course as well, that there will continue to be public submissions on any changes to those regulations. Just before winding up, Honourable Chair, a couple of final points in terms of future legislative procedures, and I know that the issue of the High Court judgment in the My Votes Counts case has been dealt with by the committee, and we agree with the position taken that that judgment does not impact on the process that is being followed by this committee in terms of this draft bill. Unfortunately, Honourable Gumede has left, but I wanted to make the point that for me, one of the critical parts of that judgment is that it locates the rights to information about the private funding of political parties directly in the Constitution. And it sets it out as a direct constitutional right emanating from the right to information that exists in the bill. So I think that's an important part of that legislation, which will be dealt with by Parliament in due course. We also make a comment, and it's something not directly affecting this committee, but we perhaps believe that it's something that should be mentioned by this committee in terms of its report to the National Assembly, that the Financial Management of Parliament and Provincial Legislatures Act needs to be reviewed. They deal with the funding that is provided to political parties in terms of Section 57 and 116, and we know that over 900 million rands of public funds are allocated to political parties in terms of these provisions, but the governing legislation lacks adequate and appropriate reporting and accountability mechanisms, making it virtually impossible to track payments and ensure proper accountability for the expenditure. This Act and the regulations, we believe, needs to be enhanced so this large pool of public funding is dealt with in a transparent, accountable, and constitutionally compliant manner. In conclusion, Honourable Chair, this process is what a civil society has been lobbying for over a decade, that political parties should disclose their private donors. This bill realizes that objective, and as I said right at the beginning, we commend this process. We believe that these measures will be hugely beneficial to our country and to enhance the quality of the transparent multi-party democratic system that is envisaged under the Constitution. The main issues remaining, as we said, were the regulation of foreign funding, the issues covered in the regulations, and the tightening of loopholes that I think we've addressed in our submission here today. We wish to thank the committee for allowing us once again to actively participate in what we believe has been a very constructive and fruitful process in this Parliament. I thank you, Chair.
Any further submissions? Are you? With that concludes everything, you will respond. Okay, Honourable Members, we have it. As usual, maybe I should kick off to allow you time to catch your breath. Thank you very much to CASAC just as a kickoff part, I hope you appreciate the difficulty that you put us in, because you really put us amongst South Africans. I'm saying that because you, for instance, came here and you said to us, no, look, it's fine not to disclose. In other words, there should be a qualified disclosure, maybe. You're saying, look, we support the bill's provision for donors to request donations of this fund to remain anonymous. And this, yesterday we had somebody saying, absolutely not. And I'm sure after you there'll be others that will remain nameless that will also say, absolutely not. They must be made available to the public. And let me just then ask the question, because I don't know if you contradicted yourself towards the end. Your slide number 2 or number 3, I don't know, but it's on page 2, where you say you support that donations or donors can request to be anonymous. And on the other side, towards the end, I thought I heard you saying you support the Western Cape judgment. And I thought the Western Cape judgment said donations must be declared. So I'm just asking the question so that we can process it, but it seems that there's a contradiction. Because people in the business yesterday said to us, if we went down the route of what you're suggesting, this bill acts will be challenged in the Constitutional Court the next day. That's what they said to us. They said it will be challenged in the Constitutional Court the next day. Now, you guys are the experts. We are mere politicians, so advise us in that regard. Also, you spoke about the 50-50 split. The question that I'm asking is, when you talk about the 50-50 split in the multi-party democracy fund, specifically, who's going to benefit from that, in light of the previous argument, where somebody was saying the multi-party democracy fund should go beyond represented political parties. So if you talk about 50-50, and you go further and you say there should be a minimum of 1%. Now, let's assume we took your argument. If 50-50 splits is the route we go, and a 1% start-up, I think that's what somebody used yesterday, start-up kitty. Exactly who are we talking about? There's 200 political parties, I think, or I don't know what the figure is, in the IEC. So does this 50-50 get split, or the 50 equitable get split among the 200 political parties? Do all 200 political parties get a minimum 1% startup? It's a real question that you guys must help us resolve. Who exactly are we talking about in terms of being beneficiaries of these funds? Because dependent on who you're talking about, the game changes drastically. Drastically. We're talking about 15 now, as opposed to in excess of 200, depending on who you think should be. So I thought, let me just put that for now. I'm going to come back later on to your foreign funding, but I'm hoping my colleagues will talk about it, but I'm certainly going to come back to it. So I just said, let me put that on for starters, Western Cape versus your provision that people should be allowed to request to be anonymous. And then the 50-50, who exactly are we talking about? Whilst I was saying that, I'm sure members were putting their thoughts together. Indications, Honourable Self, and then Honourable Matthijs.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thanks to Kazakh. May I just raise a couple of issues? I've looked very carefully at the analysis done of countries that ban and don't ban foreign donations. And, you know, you can read it in any number of ways, but what I would be interested in is some sort of correlation, if such correlation exists, between the banning of foreign donations and the extent to which there is an ordinarily accepted definition of democratic discourse. Let me just give you an example. I mean, we're all aware of Zimbabwe's rule or law that bans foreign donations. It bans foreign donations, in my view, for a very specific reason, because it doesn't want political opposition. Is there a correlation that one can draw between countries that ban foreign donations and the extent of the liberalization, liberal extent of their democracies? That's the first question. Secondly, I noticed that in the overhead or the handout that we got this morning, there is a suggestion there that all represented parties be entitled to a minimum of 1% of the public funds. I did not see that in the written submission. Am I correct that this was a new idea that was introduced today? Okay, then I've made a note of it. Then I think, you know, I appreciate where Kazakh is coming from. You want to, you're going to make sure that all the loopholes are closed and everything else like that, but it does strike me that some of the provisions that you are suggesting are extraordinarily complicated and quite onerous. Let me just give you one example of that. If you expect a donor to say, I'm going to give you 50 rand or 100 rand or 1,000 rand or whatever, but I must also now tell the IEC, that donor, I guarantee you, as I sit here, is going to say the hassle factor of that is not worth it. Not going to do it. Not going to give you money. Because why must I? It's like going to, you know, getting a TV license or something. It's a hassle. So I appreciate what you're trying to achieve in it, but I think it might have counterintuitive results. Then you say that the substantially the same donor must include the family of any donor, including the spouses of the primary donor and relatives of the first and second degree. So you're telling me that I must go and ask my daughters what they're giving to a particular political party to make sure that together we don't exceed the threshold. Is that the intention? Because my daughters will tell me to get lost. What they do with their money is their business. And I imagine that had my parents been alive, they would have said the same thing. I just think, I mean, there's personal responsibility, and, you know, everybody accepts that if I give a donation, I must stand, you know, take responsibility. But why must my daughter's rights be inhibited by my decisions and vice versa? And then, likewise, on the investment vehicles, I like the idea and I like the intention behind it, but you say here, in entities which are wholly or partly owned by a political party may not contract with any organ of state. Well, what happens if there's a holding company, or, you know, what happens if there's a subsidiary? I just think the policing of a regime like this would be incredibly complicated. I'm assuming one has to rely on the IEC to do this, and I'm not sure they have the capacity to do it. So it was a bit like the chairperson's analogy of the road and the Rolls Royce. I mean, you want actually for the thing to be rough and ready and practical so that it achieves the objective which you set out, rather than trying to set your sights too high and then not being able to implement them. I mean, there's lots of legislation on the statute book at the moment, full of good intentions, just completely. Poker is one of those, by the way. I mean, I can count on one hand the number of successful poker convictions that have taken place. Good intentions, hopeless in implementation.
But that's honorable, but
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation and the submission. I want to talk to your study, which was very informative of the wealthy and the poorest countries. And I think we should look, there's probably more to this than what it meets the eye, but what's coming out is that, of course, the wealthiest country are less reliant on foreign aid and the poorest countries are not. And is that probably why countries remain poor, because they are so reliant on foreign aid and the foreign donations or foreign aid is not really assisting them to get to that state of being more wealthy? So that is also a bigger argument of what we can consider. So there might be a little bit more that we need to look into the study. So does foreign donations actually keep a country that is poor, poor? That's the question. So I'm not saying that the foreign aid shouldn't be banned and stuff, but you've presented the study and that where it could have been the bigger picture. So I just wanted to speak to that. I'm a little bit confused on the declaring of the loans and where the tax issue comes in. I'm not saying that they shouldn't be declared, and I'm not against that, or we're not against that, but just on how the tax evasion fits into there. The dual disclosure with the IEC, how do you envision that being rolled out, as we have discussed as well? I like the idea, and I think we would agree with the penalties be in proportion to our funding that we receive in terms of percentage and stuff. Thank you. That's my input.
Let me just add my 2 cents worth, then you can respond to all of them. Very much in line with what the previous speaker spoke about, Matthijs, around the foreign. You know, the more I hear you guys speaking, and maybe I've got a mental block, the more I hate the idea, personally. The more I hate the idea. I'm talking personally. I mean, you say, when you do your analysis, those that don't receive foreign donations that are rich, 76% of them don't. Those that accept foreign donations from the poor group, 80% of them do. It really, and this is my own view, it really just smacks, it really smacks of something that's not kosher for me. And I hear what you're saying, that well, in South Africa, we might not be able to raise our own funds as a political party, so we should open the door. You know, there are people that are, and I'm probably one of them, that are passionate about the sovereignty of this country. I'd rather be poor and free than to be all right and beholden to somebody. I'd rather be poor and free. But I don't think I must be beholden to somebody because they can give me 2 cents in the name of that's just my own view. That's what I'm saying. The issues raised by the previous individual riled me up, and I'm not saying it negatively. I'm saying it just raised my consciousness. This one raised it as well, that it can't be that the poor must be beholden all the time. That's just me. The second point that I wanted to make was around the investment arms, and I agree with you. In our debate earlier on when we raised this, the point that you raised around investment arms mustn't do business with the state. They must be declared that this is an investment arm, then it must be banned from doing business with the state. It was raised and we debated it. And one of the participants here said to us, amongst ourselves, what you said, you know, if we do that, what do you say to that investment arm that donates soup, or not donates, but sells a loaf of bread to a school, or stationery to the library, or that type of thing? Because that's the state, and they're doing business with the state. And therefore, you will be killing us, because in South Africa, unfortunately, many people interact with the state from a business point of view. Not investment arms, most of us, in business somehow or the other, you're going to interact with the state. And therefore, let's leave that out and use the disclosure. That was the argument amongst ourselves here. So I'm just raising it so you can either sharpen us when we get behind closed doors, or well, not closed doors, but when we start discussing it at the party, at the committee level. Is it really practical to say they must not do business with the state? Others at the time were saying no, but they must not do substantial. In other words, the major part of their business should not be dependent on tenders and so on. So Chancellor House, or whoever you want to talk about, can't have 90% of its business dependent on state tenders. But if you say 100% must not be, you might be creating problems. That's what members of political parties said when we were having this discussion. So if you could talk to those and anything else that arises, you want to raise something else, and then we'll allow you to respond.
Thank you, Chair. Just to piggyback on what you've just raised about the investment arms, and we also had a lengthy discussion, and you're welcome to give us input on that too. It was also beyond the investment arms. We were also talking about using, what's the word that we use? Next, you know, during election mode, next minute a lot of houses are being built. What's the word that I'm looking for? My brain is going so... Exactly. So those sorts of things that are happening. So it speaks to both investment arm, the use of state resources for electioneering to that period. So give us some input, because we have been fighting and discussing that and how to monitor that. How, I mean, it's almost an impossible task to do that. So give us some advice on how to do that. Because if we're dealing with investment arms, we must also talk about the use of state resources during electioneering. I mean, SASA's next minute giving out blankets and grants during elections, and homes are being opened. I mean, it even happens during by-elections as well. So it's a huge thing of resources that highly affects the how voters, or how voters are going to be influenced. So, yeah, I'd like you to also speak to that too. Thanks.
Over to you, sir.
Thank you, and thanks for all the questions. Let me just touch on a couple of things before passing on to my colleagues to deal with some of the detail that has been raised. Chair, in relation to anonymous donors, we limit that to the Multi-Party Democracy Fund, and not to the not private donations to political parties, direct private donations to political parties. So I don't think there's a conflict with the judgment in the My Vote Counts case in that regard. In terms of the 50-50 split in the Multi-Party Democracy Fund, who will benefit? Our view has been that it is we are referring to represented political parties and not to all registered political parties. There might well be a debate that is needed to be had. I think on the basis of some of the debate here yesterday and today, there may be room to discuss that. But I think in terms of our submission, we've focused on represented political parties in that regard. In relation to the issues that Honourable Self has raised, I mean, I think I'd agree with you to the extent that we want, and I think I made this point in the first submission that we made here, that we want to contribute towards a regulatory framework that's going to be workable. We don't want to put in place something that you can't police and therefore becomes a waste of time. So to that extent, I would agree with you, and if we need to tailor some of the proposals that we've made in order to achieve that objective, I think we'd be happy to do that, because the ultimate goal is to have a workable regulatory framework rather than being dogmatic about what the actual detail needs to be. So I think we're open to it, but my colleagues will reflect on some of those issues. In terms of the taxation issue, Honourable Matthijs, is that if a company makes a large donation to a political party, it doesn't pay tax on that because it's it makes a large loan, sorry, to a political party. It will not be paying tax on that at source. Taxation will be deferred until it's repaid. And if that loan is then subsequently written off, it means that there would have been no tax paid on that loan initially. So that's sort of the mechanism or the loophole that I'm seeking to address in that regard. It's not the overriding issue. It's a subsidiary implication of the failure to disclose all loans. So the primary issue is that we believe is that all loans must be disclosed because they have the potential to have negative tax implications. I think let me pass over to Richard.
Thank you, Chair. Let me just deal with three, maybe four points, if I can contribute something. Firstly, on donations, anonymous donations to the Multi-Party Democracy Fund. My experience working in this area over 15 years now is that I don't want to come here and give evidence, but I want to share what I've picked up from having engaged with a number of donors or potential donors, particularly in the corporate sector. A number of them that I've encountered, a number that I've advised and continue to advise, including a large retailer, have shied away from giving money to political parties because of the fear that they will be sucked into some level of unethical relationship. They want, however, to be able to contribute to the building of capacity in politics and in political parties. And so I know that they would welcome, and I see the submission from Busso in this regard also, that they would welcome the opportunity that a multi-party democracy fund such as the one that would be established by the Act would create. But over and beyond that, there are some corporate donors that are not only shy of a direct relationship with a political party, but are shy of any publicity, and who simply want to quietly donate in order to support the system. And I think our point is, why would one want to shun such donations? Why would one want to turn away from the door of the system any donor that wants to give quietly, anonymously to a fund, recognizing that, of course, it's not completely anonymous because the IEC, as the governors of that fund, will pick up the donor and will be able to establish if, for example, it is an unlawful source. So that's my first point. The second around foreign aid and donations and so on, and I share your sentiment, and I don't think any of us here would want a system in which political parties in South Africa are dependent upon any donor, foreign or domestic, but certainly an interfering foreign donor, if one can put it that way. But one has to look for some consistency in the system, and I hang here on the coattails of Advocate Pottier's earlier submission, where he made the point, which I think is a strong one, that when a country as a whole is engaging in relationships with aid agencies of a variety of sorts, and drawing benefit from that for the country as a whole, why would one then limit that or exclude from the extent of such assistance political parties? That would seem to me to be inconsistent and perhaps therefore unwise. There may be many occasions that one can think of where a political party wants to learn more about what is going on elsewhere, wants to benefit from the experience of another country, and where the costs associated with such a learning, typically a study trip, are extensive and unaffordable, but a donor agency of a foreign entity is willing to support such an enterprise in order to build capacity and support learning and so on. And it seems to me that it would be unwise to exclude from the ambit of the regulation that sort of donation. Thirdly, on investment vehicles. Look, it seems to me that this is a difficult dilemma. But when one is balancing the need for political parties to be able to raise funds legitimately on the one hand in order to sustain themselves, with on the other hand the need to introduce serious and real accountability into the system, here in this area the balance should fall in favour of the second proposition. That's our essential argument here. That may be inconvenient to political parties, but there are many other ways in which political parties can raise money. In fact, this system, this new regime, should encourage and increase the level of donations coming to political parties. What we say is that political parties have to make a choice. If they are going to have investment vehicles, then by having investment vehicles, they're creating, in effect, businesses where they, as a political party, has a business interest and plays in a commercial market. And there are duties and responsibilities and inevitable interests that are triggered when one makes that choice. And we say that that choice then comes with the constraints that we say should be attached to that sort of doing business because of the danger associated with an entity such as Chancellor House, in which a political party has a direct interest, which could benefit from relationships with the state. That's the problem. And Chancellor House, unfortunately, is the best example of this. And I remember hearing the Secretary General of the ANC speaking at an event in Spin Street, not far from here, where he said, we own, quoting him, we, the ANC, own a controlling share in Chancellor House. That was what he told that audience that night. And where a political party has a controlling share in a business, then consequences flow from that. And unfortunately, in the case of Chancellor House and the Attaché matter, which, as we discussed on the last occasion, ended up with a very significant prosecution in the United States against Attaché, leading to Attaché paying a $19 million fine. The consequences of that case, I think, are sufficient alone to illustrate the dangers of allowing a lack of regulation to continue to be the norm. So our argument is that investment vehicles should attach a high degree of regulation in this new regime. Lastly, on dual disclosure, as Mr. Naidu says, Honourable Self, clearly one doesn't want to end up with a system that's unworkable and which has the unintended consequences of driving legitimate donors from the door. However, it seems to us that a donor that is making a substantial donation above a certain amount would tend to be a well-resourced, well-capacitated organization or company, and that making an additional disclosure as the donor to the IEC would not be particularly onerous. As you well know, companies have to report on a huge number of things these days. And they have the capacity, they have the inclination and the experience to make those declarations and accounts of their expenditure in a variety of forms across a variety of legislative responsibilities. This would add, of course, one more level of responsibility, legal responsibility, to their disclosure requirements, but we think that that is a small price to pay for the added benefit of having dual disclosure. It's belt and braces, as Mr. Naidu put it earlier, but I think it's important that we have a system at the end of this process in which everybody can trust it and believe that it will hold water over the long term. So, Mr. Chairman, that's the contribution I wanted to make in addition to Mr. Naidu's point. Thank you.
Thank you. I will pass over to Mr. Law to deal with a couple of the technical.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, and thank you to the members. I also just want to touch very, very briefly on the Multi-Party Democracy Fund. It correlates a little bit to what Professor Cullen was saying. There's been a fear expressed that no one's going to want to donate to this fund, or this fund, which sounds like a great idea, is going to end up struggling to get donations. I think if we start restricting or overly restricting who can donate to that fund, that's going to make that situation a lot worse. If we want this fund to work, we want this fund to receive a large amount of money, which could be able to give a substantial amount to all parties, starting to restrict things like what sort of entities can donate to it, whether it's anonymous or not, that's going to make that fund a lot more difficult to be significant. I want to touch on a few comments made by Honourable Self. The study that he suggests is a novel idea. We haven't done that study, but perhaps we could do a bit more research on that. Speaking about loopholes generally, during the research we came across a long document, quite a few pages in a document that listed how these legislative regimes and reforms failed in other countries because of various loopholes. So I think generally, and I think 15 to 20 countries that brought these pieces of legislation in had suffered from some sort of loopholes in that legislation which rendered it ineffective. So to touch on a few things. Firstly, the hassle factor with donor dual disclosure. Perhaps it's a good idea to make the threshold for a donor disclosure a little bit higher than perhaps the threshold for party disclosure. I think maybe that would limit the administrative problem to some extent. I want to tell you about how it works in Russia. In Russia, it's a good idea. What happens is both parties, the donor and the party, both fill in a payment slip, almost like a contract when a donation is made above a certain threshold. So how it would work here, someone wants to donate 200,000 rand, the party must fill in a receipt, and the donor must fill in some sort of slip saying that we donated 200,000 rand to the party. Just filling in a simple slip with a signature, and those slips both get submitted to the oversight body. I don't know if that's too much of an administrative problem. What might be a problem is knowledge on behalf of the donors that this obligation exists. And I don't think we can punish a donor for not knowing that they're supposed to report that donation to the IEC. So I think the responsibility must be on the party to inform the donor that they're required to fill out this payment slip or on the IEC. The example of your daughters.
You've got 3 minutes. Don't have a dialogue with people.
These are the technical questions. In that situation, no. The family wouldn't have to inquire to the rest of their family what donations have been made. The party must disclose. So once the party receives a donation from a company and a holding company, a family member, they know that those are substantially related entities, and they must therefore, the party must disclose. I don't think the family members must start asking amongst themselves. I think that's it from me.
I just want to, one final point. I forgot the Honourable Matthews' comment at the end about the use of state resources. I think that's something that certainly needs to be tackled, but needs to be tackled within the ambit of the Electoral Act and Code of Conduct rather than in this piece of legislation.
Right. Just on the point that the party must disclose, I think it's going to be very difficult. I support Mr. Sell. You know, I don't know that the ANC knows all Vincent's relatives, extended and rear. I don't know. So if you're saying that the party must disclose, there are a million Smiths. Must identify up all the Smiths and assume. I'm not fighting, I'm just saying I support him in terms of the practicality part of it. Just two questions to help us. You indicate that the upper limit is necessary for state capture purposes, not state capture, but capture purposes, party capture purposes. The advocates argued totally differently just now. So I just want you to comment on that. Because it assists us, not putting you against anybody else, because he seemed to think that, well, why are you making a big deal of it? It hasn't happened. That was what I got from the reason why he was advocating differently. And then just the second one. Are you saying that you adamant that we must put into the acts that the split will be 60, 40, 70, 30, 80, 20, or should we put in the act the principle that we support that whatever the split is should promote multi-party democracy? Because our argument earlier on was, let's put the principle in there and leave the 70-30, 50-30 in the regulation, purely because it is easier to change the regulation. If 70-30 might suffice today, but if it's different, or even the upper limit or lower limit suffices today, later on, it was purely a pragmatic point of view, and it's easier to change it. Also, we will put in the regulation a sentence that says these regulations are reviewable annually or whatever the case might be, which then allows for the flexibility. But we don't want the Act to be revisited every year. Now, it was just those reasons that we said, because there seems to be a sense that, no, your Act is robbing us because it doesn't have these type of things. We could put it in the Act. But it means Matthijs and the ad hoc committee will have to meet every year when the material circumstances change. I mean, that was our rationale. Would that suffice to you? And we'll ask all South Africans that question. We are your servants. If at the end of the day you say we must do it, I suppose we have no choice, we'll do it, but we just taking it from whence we come with our experience, and we don't think that it is the wisest thing to do. So if you could respond to that one, and to is it are we being drama queens and drama kings if we say there should be an upper limit because in South Africa it hasn't materialized? Matthijs?
Thank you, Chair. You haven't given us some guiding principles, since you don't want to put figures on it, on what you think the single donor cap should be. I know you said the multi-party democracy fund donate away, right? And privately to the political party recommending. So you've given us some ideas on how they do it in different countries. So what principle, at least, do you think should be our guiding light on that? Speak to that. That's what you're here to do. This is what public meetings are. You're supposed to come and give us advice on what you think could work so we can make informed decisions. And then on the issue of the resources or misuse or abuse of state resources, this is also considered resources. It's funding in a very indirect way. But you don't need to talk to that. I know that you're just trying to sidebar it. But also on what we were talking about, on whether the 50-50 principle should be, or 60, whatever it is that we're moving towards, should be in the Act. And what... It's again that the Act must be our, it must be a solid block, that it mustn't move later on. It shouldn't be something that needs to be reviewed regularly. But these are basic principles that shouldn't move on based on the conditions. It should weather all sorts of conditions. So I think in terms of the percentages, it should be based on the Constitution, and the Constitution is quite clear about it. So I don't think we should would be able to or come back in a year's time and have to review a percentage. Obviously, amounts and whatever is another story. But that's my take. We'll hear what you have to say.
Mr. Honourable Matthijs, let me deal with your first point, also covered by some of your observations, Honourable Chair. I think the principle that should guide the upper limit ceiling is one of over-dependence. I don't know if that's an elegant way of putting the point or not, or unhelpful, but the point is this, that no one single or small group of donors should become dominant in the leadership, management and running of a political party. I've had direct experience of this on the civil society side, where leading a number of organizations over many years, there are times where you find yourself overly dependent on a particular donor or set of donors, and that's not a comfortable or desirable state of affairs. And I don't believe it's in the interests of the political system that any political party, particular one that has large representation or that is in the executive, should be overly dependent. Now, how you turn overly dependent as a principle into numbers is a problem for me, because I don't know the landscape, because at the moment we simply don't know, of course, the budgets of political parties. We don't know where your donors come from. We don't know how many you have. So it's very difficult to then articulate a sensible proposition in relation to what an appropriate number should be. But I think the principle should be over-dependence, and then you then have to look in the context of the budget and the overall revenue and donations of a political party to figure out what would be an appropriate way of articulating that principle of over-dependence in numerical or perhaps percentage terms. And it may well be that a rule such as no donor should be responsible or donated more than X percent, 30%, 50% of a particular political party's budget. That would be a conversion then into numbers of the principle of over-dependence. Thank you.
I can just add, Honourable Chair, a couple of issues. You know, on the issue, or the direct question in relation to what Advocate Pothier has said this morning in relation to no ceiling, and there's no evidence that there has been party capture, if I can use that phrase, I think it would be considerate of us in the current climate of allegations around state capture and the manner in which our politics have been contaminated by these issues, that it would be prudent for us to tackle this issue. To say that it hasn't happened, we may not know whether it's happened or not. It might well have happened, we're unaware of it because we don't know who is funding political parties. So I think we should, strongly urge that we do put in place a ceiling as a matter of principle. In relation to the issue of whether the formula should find expression in the Act or in the regulations, I mean, we do believe that it should find expression in the Act because I think it's an issue of principled importance. And we don't see any reason why the formula should be changed on a regular basis. If extraordinary circumstances exist that it does need to be revisited, then it might be appropriate for it to be done as an amendment to the Act. But we think that it is of such fundamental importance that it should find expression in the Principal Act. However, again, if political parties across the board are comfortable with leaving it in the regulations, we will not continue our objection to that. But that's the principal position on which we base our argument.
Thank you very much to the team from CASAC. Thanks as usual for your insistence on arguing with us and testing our logic, but we will take everything into consideration. Prof. Lawson and Mike, thank you very much, gentlemen. Alright. Honourable members, we are running slightly behind. Thank you very much, guys. Right, you know, Mr. Hunter and Mr. Galant, are you here? They are. All right. We have given Right to Know 20 minutes to present, and the committee will engage with your comments for 20 minutes. So we're prepared to defend whatever you're about to say. Members of the committee will deal with it in 20 minutes after you've done your initial 20 minutes. And it is in your file number 17 or your 17th submission, and there are no PowerPoints, so Right to Know are going to talk directly to the substantial submission that they made, which you should find about the 17th in your pack, honorable members. Over to you, sir. It is at 10 to we'll stop you.
Thank you, Chairperson, and good morning to the committee, or good afternoon, no, it's good morning still. So my name is Murray Hunter, I'm a researcher with the Right to Know campaign. Presenting with me is Mr. Khalid Khalant, who's a member of Right to Know's National Working Group, amongst other things. And we're two of the people who worked on the submission. Chairperson, we may not actually even take all the time available to us because it is a short supplementary submission. And so we've just flagged some of the issues that were raised in the original draft where there was some discussion with the committee and a few of the things that we would like to raise with the draft bill. And maybe just to start off to really acknowledge the work of the committee in turning around from a draft proposal to a draft bill very quickly. We do appreciate how quickly that has been produced, and it's very welcome. Thank you. So I'm going to hand over to Mr. Khalid, or Khalid if I may.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone. Perhaps we'll just dive in. That there's a, as Right to Know, we believe there's a critical need for political parties to make historical financial information available. So we dealt with that point in the previous submission as well. At present, there's no reliable public picture of what political parties' finances and funding situations are. Rough estimates suggest that in the 2009 elections, political parties together spent about 550 million rand on campaigning, with a small fraction of that, about 93 million rand, only coming from public funds. It's been suggested that spending during the last round of elections that we had at local government level, that may have been much higher, and we all remember the reports of one ANC office bearer suggesting that that party's electoral budget was in the region of R1 billion. Whether that is so or not, these basic numbers are entirely speculative. And
The challenge is that if we don't know, what are we in fact legislating for? So there are a range of questions that must be answered in order to critically evaluate this draft bill. These include: how many donations do political parties receive? What's the average size of the donation? What are parties' total income and expenditure? What's the sum of direct donations that will be prohibited under the draft bill? In other words, what is the funding shortfall that the regulations will create? Detailed information about party finances and spending is generally in the public interest, we would argue. However, it's also of material importance for the work of this committee. Without this information, the draft bill seeks to regulate party finances without a common understanding of the current conditions of party finances. And whether the draft legislation, therefore, will in fact answer the need that has been identified with this bill. Parliament will essentially be legislating in the dark. When it comes to a need for public participation of the draft bill, also the public is especially disadvantaged, since it is assumed that you as members of the committee each have some knowledge of your own party's finances, but perhaps no clear picture of the finances of each other's political party. And even more so, the public is not privy to that information. Members of the public who are not senior leaders within a political party don't even have that limited insight. So as R2K, what we urge the committee once again is to ensure that parties make a joint disclosure, however difficult that may be, of their previous financial records as part of the reform process, to essentially set a baseline of knowledge. And that would give this committee the ability to pass effective and recommend appropriate legislation. It's entirely feasible to make such disclosures, we would want to warrant, without breaching legitimately confidential information, because that's been a concern that has been raised. Where it is genuinely necessary to prevent the disclosure of certain information, the record holder may redact sensitive information from the record before making it public. So we have mechanisms for that. In the absence of this information, we're not in a position to make detailed comments on some of the draft bill's provisions, because so much of this draft bill hangs on having a clear a baseline from which we are working.
So I'm sure that the committee will want to discuss that, but I think in terms of proactive disclosure and regular proactive disclosure, we obviously, it should go without saying that we really welcome the direction that the bill has gone in requiring from going forward a regular proactive disclosure of private donations to political parties. Just one thing I would like to flag is that we had proposed to the committee that rather than making it an annual disclosure, we should see quarterly disclosures. And we'd heard from some members of the committee that would, you know, be unfeasible or unreasonable. We would like to make the case again to the committee, drawing on some of the information that has been put to the committee from Advocate Gary Pinard, who's done research on this, and an audit of international laws. We've seen a number of jurisdictions where parties are required to make disclosures to the public more regularly than on an annual basis. So, for instance, Croatia is disclosing quarterly. In the U.S., before elective seasons, national political committees are required to make disclosures every month. So there are a number of jurisdictions that we feel the committee can look at to look at more regular disclosure. We do think that a quarterly basis rather than an annual basis is the best possible way to ensure regular information that is available to the public and to the legislature to ensure that that parties are compliant with their obligations and that that transparency is being adhered to. Another point we'd like to raise is that the bill correctly includes provisions for public disclosures of donations, which includes goods and services. The fact that those are in-kind donations is welcomed. The one concern that we want to raise is that there's an exemption of personal services provided at a voluntary basis. And we suggest that there's a prescribed value for each donation provided. And those may be in the regulations rather than in the law itself, but that the prescribed value be subject to the quarterly public disclosure regime as well, so essentially that everything is happening quarterly. Another point that we'd like to raise on this is where the private sector and corporate donors to political parties or to the Democracy Fund are making disclosures, we would want a dual disclosure system. So companies of corporate donations to political parties are actually disclosing as to the multi-party Democracy Fund as well. And then I think the final point we just want to emphasize is that there has been some discussion of complete confidentiality of the donations to the multi-party Democracy Fund, and we do appreciate some of the considerations there. But we do think that there is a cause for some information about who is donating to the multi-party Democracy Fund to be made available. And again, that doesn't need to be blanket transparency, but at least where a threshold has been set for disclosures. So we can talk more about that, and I'm sure the committee has some questions, but Khalid, do you want to take it from there?
So the draft bill provides, Honourable Chair, for necessary prohibitions on donations where the risk of undue influence and the resulting threat to multi-party democracy is extremely high. And I think that's the major risk that most of us are concerned about in relation to party funding. However, not even public disclosure in these unique instances can alleviate the threat. We offer no objections to the current provisions in the provided for in the bill. We do want to draw attention, though, to two major areas where corruption and undue influence of money in politics has already marred our democracy. And you have already been discussing this. The one area is donations from private companies doing business with the state, and then the activities of political party investment vehicles. The most notable one, as has already been mentioned this morning, the ANC's Chancellor House. For us in Right to Know, the history of corruption scandals, particularly around public procurement at all levels of government, have already demonstrated the risk of these unique relationships and the danger that they pose both to the public fiscus but also to service delivery. In RFK's previous submission, we called for a complete ban on donations from private companies doing business with the state. That's too close a relationship really to countenance, and the danger of purchasing influence is a very real one. So we repeat this call in the submission, with the addition that where a company or its subsidiaries does business with the state, all the executives and board members, beneficial owners and spouses of them should make proactive disclosures of any donations of public to political parties. And we don't believe that that should be too big a hassle. The risk that we are trying to avoid is a much greater interest. Some of the major funding corruption scandals have involved political party investment vehicles, and indeed this could be said to be at the heart of any political party funding corruption in South Africa. In the absence of a complete ban on investment vehicles, we call for at least a mandatory annual disclosure of the investments to be made made to the fund and prohibitions on them doing business with the state.
You're 10 minutes up. 1 minute.
Oh, sorry, I thought we had 20 minutes, sir. Okay. Then very briefly, one of the key, the final issues is disclosure threshold. We understand that the committee is really calling for a concrete number to be put to what we think that a disclosure threshold should be. At the risk of sounding like a broken record, we really want to emphasize without some disclosures from political parties about what current donations look like, it is very difficult to find a practical and appropriate threshold to reach to. We have thrown out in our previous submission the possibility of linking the threshold very closely to markers for inequality in our society to ensure that individual donors are not able to influence politics beyond what, for instance, the average household would be able to spend in a month. But we once again want to appeal to the committee to make that information available, if at all possible. The final thing is that where individuals are disclosing below the threshold, that their combined donation should be considered and tallied in order to assess whether or not they're above or below the threshold.
With your indulgence, Honourable Chair, 30 seconds, I promise, just on the last issue on public funding, because the issue of 90-10, 50-50, 60-40 has been traversed in other submissions. We don't wish to do that, but want to propose that in terms of the allocation, that the national and provincial allocations actually be split up. And really we believe that that's important for multi-party democracy, which is expressed in different ways across the different provinces and at a national level. Lumping it all together, we believe, is a mistake. And the national allocation ought to be divided according to percentage seats occupied in the House. Provincial allocation similarly divided equally across the 9 provinces and within those provinces according to the percentage seats occupied in the provincial legislature. So those are perhaps some ideas we wish to present.
Thank you very much. All ideas are welcome. But as we say to everybody else, we are not going to not challenge some of the things you say. Let me start with your comments. You sort of said that because we don't know what the history is, Parliament is regulating in the dark. Now, I have a different view, because that assumption thinks that the only thing we're doing is the upper limit, the lower limit, and the 90-10. This bill is far more than that. So to suggest that because we don't know how much the ANC or the DA spent in the last elections renders what we're doing somehow, I don't know, not irrelevant, but somehow weak. I contest that, because here there's far-reaching principles that we put in here, disclosure and so on. So I don't think it's correct to come and say that we, and I'm not challenging you or fighting with you, but I think if you come here and you make comments, you must expect that we will give the same back to you. So that's the first, just overall point that you're making. And your insistence on retrospective information, I'm not understanding why you want that information. I'll tell you, one, is not practical, in the sense that if you went to any political party here and you said to them, give me your data for 2 years ago, even if I had it and I gave it to you, of what value is it? Because one, we didn't have an obligation to disclose. That is why we're doing this now. So you probably get half the information. Even that half that you get has never been audited. So there's no ways of assessing whether it is accurate, whether it's 100% of the information. And that is the purpose why we're doing it now, so that if you ask this question today going forward, there should be no reason not to get it. But to ask of that information even a year ago, you'd probably get that information and it would be totally useless information. For whatever purpose you want to use it, it would be totally useless information. It's not been audited. You don't know if it's 100%, because firstly, people didn't have the need to do it. So I'm trying to understand your rationale of retrospective information. Because what we're putting here now is what we think, certainly in terms of the threshold, in terms of the upper limit, in terms of the 90-10, we're putting what we think is workable, practical, and makes South Africans feel comfortable that going forward we will be better off than we were yesterday. How enforceable is retrospective? I'm not sure. Constitutional Court still has to confirm what the Western Cape Court did 2 weeks ago. So if you came to me and you said to me, I must do it, what enforceability do you have? What enforceability do you have to political parties to give it to you? I'm just saying to you, you must explain to me why we should continue to do that going forward. So those are the two points that I wanted to raise broadly. Members will raise issues specifically, and then I'll come back. As usual, you'll have a first round to respond, members will have a second round, and you'll have a second round to respond. Honourable Matthijs.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for your presentation. Your principle for disclosure that you're suggesting is a link to the average monthly household income. Would that be what we kept? Okay. So you're suggesting that it should be monthly, the monthly average household income times 12, and then that would be what you need to start disclosing, or you're saying just the monthly income for a yearly donation? Am I making sense? So we're going to say the monthly household income, let's say, is 10,000 times 12, and then that would be the cap where we start disclosing. Rasmus, I don't think you did your research very properly, because you come in here and you're making a recommendation of something that's not constitutional in terms of the distribution of political party funds. Now, the Constitution is very clear that the constituency allowance, which is allocated proportionally and in line with seats, right? It's in the Constitution. We're not fighting that. When it talks about political party support, it's talking about both proportional and equitable. Right? And it's not says which one should get more. So I'm very surprised that you are coming here and making such a recommendation that this should be allocated according to the number of seats, when it does not find any expression in the Constitution on what you're recommending. So that's very disappointing. The other issue the chairperson has spoken about audits, and I just want to clarify, I don't know if you're speaking just on behalf of the ANC, but as the EFF, our accounts are audited regularly since we started, yearly, all our accounts. So they are available, and if that decision is made that we disclose, I'm sure we'll be available to do so.
Comrade Godin.
Thank you, Comrade Chair. The recommendation for quarterly disclosures as opposed to an annual one, is it a nice to have, or how substantively does it enhance anything in the disclosure process?
All right, so over to you.
Chairperson, maybe first to address the question you've raised about the retrospective disclosure proposal. We understand that it would be subject to challenge, and that it is a significant ask of political parties to make that information available. Firstly, our assumption is that those funds have been audited, that each party, it was our assumption that each party is subjecting its own internal finances to independent audit. But secondly, and I think the two stands to your questions, firstly, what is the practical use of the information, and secondly, what is the mechanism? The practical use of the information is for us, a range of things. The first is that when the regulations that Parliament has been asked to produce, or the law and the regulations, will firstly determine what the minimum disclosure should be for political parties. But there's very little information available about how many donations political parties currently receive and at what level. So deciding where that threshold exists, if we set the threshold at 5,000, do we know that actually 90% of a political party's donations fall under 5,000 and only 10% go over 5,000? Do we know what the average amount is?
So it's very important for us to be able to find a targeted threshold that is practical for parties to implement and serve the need for transparency. The second is that some parties have raised the concern that the disclosure requirements will reduce the number of donations that parties will seek private donations as people sort of decide that they don't want to be proactively disclosing. To understand what parties' annual incomes are and annual expenditures are is very, very valuable for us to see how effective the regulations have been once they're passed, and whether there is a shortfall in funding, which must be made up with public funds, is my presumption. So we think from a research point of view, and it's not necessarily information that will be explosive or politically explosive, but from a research point of view, firstly, assessing and adjusting the regulations, and secondly, once the regulations have been passed, understanding their effectiveness would be very valuable going forward. Then the question of how that disclosure will be enforced. It's our appeal to this committee that each political party be consulted about making that information jointly available to the committee as a way of actually showing faith in this process that's unfolding. It could be possible to make, for instance, a higher request to political parties for their audited financial statements. And judging from what we're seeing in the courts, those requests would presumably be viewed as lawful requests. But it's our first hope that the committee will see the value in this information and consult amongst members of the committee to make that information available. So that's hopefully addressing some of your questions. Honourable Godi's question about the quarterly disclosures, if I understand correctly, you're asking if it's a nice to have or not. We believe that the transparency that will be served by having quarterly disclosures makes it more than a nice to have. I mean, obviously, annual disclosures would be better than no disclosures, but in our view, quarterly disclosures would be better than annual disclosures and really promote a new level of transparency that all parties can commit to. There was one other question from Honourable Mathis.
I just want to respond to Honourable Mathis. I think what we're wanting to propose is the additional split between national and provincial. So I take the point around the constitutional provision around proportional and equitable share. And I prefaced my statements by not wanting to get into percentage debate. But that principle, we're arguing, ought to take into account the provincial reality as well as the national reality. At the moment, the discussion has been just at the national picture.
Second taker? Honourable Goda?
Thank you, Chairperson. I would suggest that requesting previous data from political parties at this stage may be a nice to have in terms of research, but that's not our mandate, it's not our task. Parties do, all public funds that parties receive from the IEC are audited, those audit statements are available. But to ask the committee now to go down the route of delving into the past, it's not our mandate. We simply can't do that.
Just a last comment. One of the things in the proposal that we didn't touch on was the expenditure caps. So some of the numbers, 550 million rand in 2009, maybe a billion, at least that much spent on campaigning. And we're talking here about public funding now. So how much does a political party need to do its campaigning is an important question for this committee to ask. And it's really important that our political system doesn't get sucked up into chasing the money. We have a number of jurisdictions on this continent. I've just come back from Kenya, where they have extremely onerous expenditure caps down to MP level, how much an MP can spend on his or her campaign, explicitly detailed. Now, we're not proposing that, but it comes from a place of wanting to limit the cost to the public fiscus, but also the cost to society of political campaigning. And that's really why we're asking for the baseline information, that we need to understand where we're coming from, how much money is sloshing around in the system for political campaigning, and what is reasonable. That surely is a task for this committee.
Sorry, we hear you. I think Honourable Mother's point is still there. Our constitution, our mandate was very clear. I don't think anybody is saying don't go that route. I'm just talking about the mandate of this committee. It's very clear. And I suppose civil society and everybody else could go and try and get that information, because it'll be useful. Information is power. But from the committee point of view, I think it's not going to be possible to do that, although we think that it is something that is worthwhile pursuing if it's going to assist us in terms of, as you say, the baseline, and also evaluating how effective we are going forward. There is fresh tea. I know there's people that like their tea warm, but as you do that, please don't disturb the rest of us. We're going to break for lunch in about an hour. Thank you very much to gentlemen from Right to Know. We certainly will take all those things into consideration when we mull over the final product from next week going forward. The South African History Archives, are they available? Yes, ma'am. If you could come and take your place, and thereafter we will break for lunch. Immediately after lunch at 2 would be the Helen Suzman Foundation, Corruption Watch, My Vote Counts, Business Unity South Africa of VLSA, and that would be the lineup for after lunch. You have about 20 minutes left. It is 25 past, we'll ask you to stop, and then the committee itself, that's the maximum. You can do it in short if you want to. The committee will have 20 minutes, which will make it around about 10 to, which will give us sufficient time to break for lunch, honorable members. The presentation should be your 18th in your file, and there is no PowerPoint, so they will, or Ms. Van Wyk will talk directly to the presentation. Over to you, Ms. Van Wyk, and we will stop you around about 25 past.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, committee members. Just like a number of other people today, I wanted to say thank you for the hard work of the committee. This is obviously a very important issue for SAHA. The transparency aspect is critical, and it's very important work, and it's laudable how quickly you've managed to turn things around. The submissions today, in the written submission, it splits up into general comments and specific comments on specific provisions, as well as some comments on what we believe to be typographical errors. I won't go into the typographical errors. I'll just highlight some of the general and specific comments. In terms of general comments, we've made some comments on the two funds as other submissions already to this committee. We note that while the sources of the funds are different, that would be reflected in accounting. The funds aren't distributed any differently, and to the extent that remains unchanged, having more than one fund doesn't seem necessary. We do note that Section 236 of the Constitution requires that parties participating in the national and provincial legislature be provided with funding. That would happen through the Represented Political Party Fund. So we believe that given that there's a constitutional mandate to encourage multi-party democracy, really the fund should be encouraging development of the political space, and so the Multi-Party Democracy Fund should also fund unrepresented parties. We haven't made submissions as to how that should be determined, but note the submissions this morning from the Catholic Bishops' Conference with agreement. With respect to transparency, transparency, we note that access to information requires three important steps: that a record be created, that it be kept, and that it be disclosed. We note that the bill makes some provision for record creation, although not very expressly. It requires reporting, and it's assumed, therefore, that there will be record creation. It makes no provision for record keeping, and it does make limited provision for disclosure. We propose that the record keeping issue be addressed through a general record keeping and disclosure clause. We're suggesting wording similar to what can be found in some financial legislation that regulates finances, such as the Municipal Finance Management Act. So a general clause, I'm not going to give exact wording, there is some suggested exact wording in the written submission, but generally it would cover that records have to be stored in a manner that would ensure their integrity so that they won't be tampered with, that they also won't be subject to being burnt down, more than one copy, so that if one copy is damaged, another is there. And then disclosure that ought to happen in terms of the Act must happen on a website as well, and that records should also be available at head and satellite offices. Mm-hmm. At head and satellite offices. And then with respect to applicability, as it stands, the bill is only applicable to represented parties in national and provincial legislature. We note that the arguments for regulating party funding apply in the same way to funding at local level. We do take account of the fact that Section 236 of the Constitution limits funding from the represented political party fund to national and provincial represented parties, but provision can still be made to with respect to funding through the Multi-Party Democracy Fund, and provision can still be made with respect to transparency at the local level. And to the extent that this bill doesn't address that at this stage, we would recommend that at least it should set time frames for amendments to address the issue at local level. On specific provisions, we've noted that the preamble makes no mention of the requirements in Section 19.3 on the right to vote. We've noted in a previous submission that our Constitutional Court has recognized that the inequality of wealth in South Africa requires that the inequality of access to politicians be balanced, and that as part of the right to vote. And so we suggest that it would be prudent to note that Section 19 and Section 7.2, which requires the Parliament to give effect to rights in the Bill of Rights, be recognised. Section 3.5 makes contributions to, sorry, makes provision for contributions to the Multi-Party Democracy Fund, where requesters can request non-disclosure of their identity or the amount donated. We've heard a number of submissions on that point. Our view is that if you're supporting the Multi-Party Democracy Fund, you're supporting democracy. It's difficult to see why anyone would want to keep that secret. If I were a company, I would use it to promote myself. Be that as it may, if there is reason, then at least there should be some level of disclosure of the nature of the person, so the kind of business that they're involved. That will give the public some idea of the kinds of businesses that are funding democracy, etc. Section 7.1F allows for monies from the funds to be used to, quote, ensure continuous and vital links between people and the and organs of state. I struggle to understand what that exactly entails, but it sounds to me like it's trying to shift a constitutional burden on the organs of state to engage their constituencies, which would seem unconstitutional, so perhaps the wording there can be revisited. Section 7.1F. Okay. Section 10 provides for the disclosure to the Commission only if the threshold is met. We propose that while there should be public disclosure only of donations that meet the threshold, there should be full disclosure to the Commission. This would enable the Commission to monitor compliance. It would also allow the Commission to, down the line, if it's possible, give some anonymized aggregate reporting. So again, it could say the nature of the businesses that are contributing directly to parties, the kinds of amounts that aren't meeting the threshold that are being given, etc. Then effective access to information requires that data be meaningful, and that would include that it be comparable, and also that it would make it possible to monitor again compliance. We suggest that this would be achieved if the bill at least prescribes some categories of information that the form for disclosure should include. We've made recommendations in the written submission that includes full names, other names that a donor is known by, their principal occupational business, the date of the agreement or the date of the donation, the value and the nature of the donation and any conditions attached. There's no notes on that in the written submission, but that's based on US and Irish legislation. Then, with respect to the threshold, we have no objection to it being specified in the regulation. Again, we do think that there can be some guidance in the bill. For example, that it has to be set in consultation with experts, that it has to be in line with international standards, and that it has to have reference to historic data. I've heard the comments to Right to Know on historic data. To the extent that historic data is not available at this stage, then in years forward, where that threshold is revised, historic data can be taken into account. Section 13. There is a need to ensure compliance with the disclosure provisions in Section 10, and we therefore propose that Section 13 should include an express provision that the auditors need to audit compliance with disclosure provisions, as it does certain other things. And then Section 14 provides for the repayment of money out of the funds, quote, to the Commission. We just recommend something small, that the language be changed to back into the relevant fund. So it comes, particularly if the funds are going to be distributed in different ways, then it goes back just directly into the fund it came out of. Section 16.1 confers the power on the Commission to issue directives, but it has no obligation. We note that administrative law would require an opportunity on parties to give some sort of response, and so we recommend that it be mandatory. Section 22.2 makes provision for reporting on funding from national and provincial legislature, but it makes no provision for public disclosure of that information. We recommend that it should be publicly disclosed. We recommend some similar timeframes and mediums to what is provided for in other legislation like the Municipal Finance Management Act, which is 30 days on websites in head offices and satellite offices. Then in Chapter 5 in the enforcement provisions, there's no, rather the directives are required if there's going to be an imposition of sanctions only. Currently, with respect to the suspending of payments, we propose that administrative justice requires that such directives be issued in every instance, and therefore that it be mandatory to issue those in every instance before imposing any sanction. We propose that the chapter should give some guidance with respect to whether cumulative sanctions can be imposed by the Commission, in other words, not just a fine, but a fine and suspension of payments, and then whether the Commission can make regulations for its own investigations under this chapter. And then in the schedule, we note that there's a three-year period. We want to suggest that the Commission should consider whether it shouldn't be a rolling three-year period. And then lastly, just on the draft regulations, we have no comments on them as they stand. Thank you.
Thank you very much, ma'am. As usual, let me kick off. Let me take you to, I didn't understand when you said to us you got, you think it's unconstitutional. Your point 7F, I think it was. If you look at point 7, 7 says the Commission must pay the allocated amount to each represented political party in intervals, okay? That's 7. Then 7.1 says, subsection 2, the money paid according to what I've just read, or 6.7 that I read initially. It says the money paid according to 6.7 may be used by political parties. What for? To ensure continuous and vital links between people and organs of state. And you think that seems to you that we are moving the constitutional responsibility to organs of state. I'm not reading it as such. It says that money may be used by political parties. What for? For political parties to link up the people and organs of state. And that is our role. We are representatives of the people. That's what we do 90% of the time. And what this thing is saying that money must be used for that purpose. So I think that's our primary role as politicians, to be the representatives of the people. So if we are emphasizing here that give political parties that money, but that money or part of it should be used so that political party, members of political parties must link the ordinary South Africans to organs of state, I think that is totally consistent with what we are supposed to be doing, but you can talk to that. Then the second one, you were suggesting a whole host of specific things in terms of record keeping. Now we've got expert Gordy, Comrade Gordy here. My understanding is that if you say that activities of political parties must be audited by a competent auditor, by default, it means that there must be records that must be there for the auditor to be able to do the audit, otherwise it qualifies you for lack of supporting documents. Because you said it's record keeping, it's disclosure, and all those type of things. My thinking is that unless you want this to be a 35-page document with every detail, by saying political parties must have their records audited, I think would encompass all those things you're talking about. And I'm looking at this side of the table. But if you want to put it, audit means have a document, audit means do this, we could do that, but I think it'll make it just very onerous. So those are my two submissions that I think your concerns are covered by saying it should be audited, because you can't audit unless you've got proper record keeping, you've got proper disclosure, and those type of things. So those would be my two comments to kickstart. But if members have anything else they'd want to add, now is your chance to do so, honourable members. If anybody has, Comrade Gordy, and then Honourable Matei.
No, I just want to say you've covered.
Okay. Thank you. Just quickly, you are requesting that you understand that we don't have a mandate to include local government, and we have been cognitive of that, including local government in terms of funding. And we did have Saga also come to do a presentation yesterday, and we explained the same thing. But we said we could, in our report to Parliament, note that there has been, you know, many submissions for us to include local government in here. But you have stated that you're mindful of that in your submission. But you want this to include disclosure. You want this bill or this act to include disclosure even on the local government level, even though the funding, the political party funding is not covering them. Is that what you are requesting? And I would suggest that, do you think that a better way for us to deal with the disclosure would be go to SALGA and let that be covered in the Municipals Act or something like that on that regard? And when you talk about disclosures, I just want to be clear. You do there's two types of disclosure. There's the disclosure of a political party is going to say, regardless of whether someone donated 5 cents or 2 cents, we're going to report that our donations have been 300,000 for the year, right? And that will cover all the amounts of money that we've received. Then the secondary disclosure that I'm using very loosely the word would be, okay, so after someone has donated 100 rand, now we're going to keep a record of this person's name and where the money has come from. So I just want to understand that when you're talking about disclosure, which one of those are you referring to, or are you saying that we must keep records of even those that donate 2 rand, for example? Okay, that's it.
Over to you, Matt.
Thank you, Chair. My comment on Section 7F wasn't to say that political parties shouldn't play a role in, as I understand, the emphasis for you is on supporting the people's connection with the organs of state. My comment had been, and perhaps that was because I'm not involved in politics at all, that organs of state have a constitutional duty to make sure they engage their constituencies, and that duty then becomes the duty of political parties. But from what you say, it has more to do with supporting the people in connecting with the organs of state, which is different, and I take that point. Thank you. The comment on auditing, I agree that to be able to audit, you'd have to have supporting documents. However, that doesn't speak to standards of record keeping. That doesn't say that records have to be kept in general. I mean, if you are audited and something did happen and your records were destroyed, an issue would arise at that point. You might get an audit finding against you. But that doesn't mean that people will therefore keep record in a way that would ensure the integrity of the records, that would ensure there's multiple versions of the record. And I don't think adding in a general clause requiring that records be kept for a certain period, so again, it doesn't mean that records have to be kept for 7 years. They have to be kept for the audit. But if someone needs to go back years later, so for example in the Companies Act, certain records have to be kept forever and certain records have to be kept for 7 years, etc. So there could be something specific around that. Similar with disclosure, auditing obviously doesn't really speak to disclosure. There's disclosure to the auditors, but not to the public and the IEC. And when I was talking about disclosure, I was saying what the IEC has to disclose, that in general, just the one-liner in the bill, require that the IEC makes that information accessible on a website and also at their head and satellite offices. And then, Honourable Matthijs, thank you for the explanation around no mandate with respect to local government. I would say that, yes, I am suggesting that there should be record keeping, even of donations. So if the donations meet, and it's specifically for parties that are only contesting at the local level, and they meet the threshold, I think there should be disclosure. If this committee feels that it doesn't have the mandate to address that in this bill, then I would ask that it be noted in a report to Parliament. Thank you.
Okay, just one comment again. And you don't have to respond to it. You know, the point that you made just now. I think we take the point that the IEC must make the records accessible, cheap, and all those type of things. I'm just cautioning you where you say we must make it available on a website, because in 1980. If we were doing this thing in 1980, you would be coming to us to say you must make it available on a ledger. If you came to us in the 1990s, you'd be saying just make it available on a CD. You're coming to us today and you're saying make it available on a website. It's not inconceivable that a website will be obsolete in a couple of years. You'll recall what we've been saying the whole week. We want to build a road that will stand the test of time, whether a truck, a Rolls Royce, or a bicycle. So yeah, I think ours, by saying it must be made, we must disclose it, and it must be accessible to South Africans, should suffice. When we become specific and say on a memory stick, on a website, 5 years time when there's no website, or you're also assuming that everybody's got internet access. I'm not fighting with you, I'm just saying, these are the things that these people have to sit and think about every day when we look at what we're saying, because a website almost becomes restrictive to those that have internet. But if we said let's make it disclosable and leave the IEC in its own regulations to implement it, however best that implementation is in the different localities of not only South Africa, because it must then become available even to our brothers and sisters overseas, I would assume. So I think, for me, if we say it must be disclosable, it must be easily accessible, we can fight about the regularity, whether it's a month or a year or 5 months, but I think that should suffice, because ours is to make sure that it stands the test of time regardless of the circumstances that prevail at that moment. Would that suffice?
Thank you. I agree that it's important that it stands the test of time. The suggestion from a website also arises from other South African legislation with disclosure requirements. I would support wording that speaks to it being as widely and as cheaply accessible as possible. Yeah.
Thank you very much. I think that would help us. I mean, I don't know if there's a second by that honourable members want. If there isn't, honourable members, I've been trying to nudge Cindy to see if lunch will be ready. Okay. Our next submission was going to be Rod Helen Suzman, scheduled for 2 o'clock. They are here. Okay. And okay. I want to propose, honourable members, that we break for lunch now. We come back at 2 o'clock, but to our colleagues here, as is become practice, there will be some finger lunch made available, so you are more than welcome to share it with us. Because we finished a few minutes earlier, I'm sure we probably have 5 or 7 minutes before they start rolling it in their trolleys, but we will break and we will reconvene at 2 o'clock, and the Helen Suzman Foundation will be first up at 2 o'clock. So, honourable members, as was the case yesterday, so is it today, both you and everybody else. We can leave our documents here, and we hope to see everybody at 2 o'clock. We are scheduled to start at 2 o'clock sharp. So, Helen Suzman Foundation, at 2 o'clock, you'll be called to take up your seats. Meeting adjourned until 2.